with all the news and opinion. Put it in the news categories you want. Listen to a range of podcasts. Download the LBC app and Global Player from the App Store or Google Play. Coming up on one on LBC is Richard Spur. But first, it's my favourite, Ben Kentish.
Oh, has he got less favourite, Ben Kentish?
You've always been one of my favourites, Ben.
Ali, thank you very much indeed. Lovely to see you. Lots coming up on the show tonight. Just a day after vowing to get tough and deport more foreign criminals, now LBC learns that Labour is also planning to stop migrants using human rights laws to avoid deportation. All of this, of course, while Reform is accusing asylum seekers of posing a major threat to women, and protests outside migrant hotels continue. We are becoming, as a country, aren't we, more and more hostile to immigration, particularly people who come here to claim asylum. And you might think that's a good thing. You might think it's long overdue, but not everyone agrees. Today, more than 200 organisations demand that our politicians stop fueling racism. Have they got a point?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, Downing Street says peace must be built with Ukraine, not imposed upon it, after Donald Trump confirmed the country's president won't be invited to talks between him and Russia's leader. The US president says he'll call Volodymyr Zelensky instead after Friday's meeting. LBC's US correspondent Simon Marks listened to Mr. Trump's remarks.
It became very evident that all of those efforts by the Europeans over the weekend to try and make sure that the United States is going to be fully cognizant of Volodymyr Zelensky's needs going into any kind of peace process. All of that appears to have been for naught.
The UN is calling for an independent investigation into the killings of five journalists in Gaza. Among them was prominent Al Jazeera reporter Anas Al-Sharif, who Israel alleges led a terror cell. His employer denies it. The UN's Stéphane Dujarric says civilians are suffering.
The World Food Programme said more than a third of the population is not eating for days at a time, and acute malnutrition is spiking, with over 300,000 children at severe risk.
People in southern England are being told to brace for temperatures in the mid-30s tomorrow. An amber heat health alert is in place. And London is under a pollution warning too, as weatherman John Hammond explains.
It's linked to the fact that we've got a fairly static atmospheric setup. There's not a lot of breeze, and a lot of sunlight will actually act to sort of excite the pollutants in the lower atmosphere. So it is indirectly linked to the high temperatures, in as much as we've got a lot of sunshine.
A Labour peer is calling for a statue of a British imperialist to be removed from outside the Foreign Office. Thangam Debonair told LBC visiting Indian citizens should not be forced to walk past the memorial to Robert Clive, who paved the way for the British Raj. Baroness Debonair says the statue suggests it was wholly positive to be ruled from the UK.
When India finally achieved its independence, it left India impoverished. Since independence, India, under its own steam, has been able to grow, thrive. Its literacy rate has gone from the 16% that Britain left it with to over 70%. Any number of things have been transformed by independence.
And Emma Raducanu's out at the Cincinnati Open, coming out on the wrong end of a titanic battle with world number one Aryna Sabalenka. The Brits lost the third round match in a third set tiebreak, 7-5. In the city, the FTSE 100 closed up 33 points at 91.29. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.16. LBC weather, the odd spot of rain for North Wales, Northern Scotland and Northern England tonight. Dry and mainly clear elsewhere. Lows ranging from 13 to 19 degrees. Sunny tomorrow. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Matt Hewitt.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ben Kentish.
It's 10:03. Hello and a very, very good evening to you. Listen to Ben Kentish here on LBC with you for the next 3 hours, during which time we have got a lot to discuss. Coming up,
the Met struggles with finding cell space for prisoners. So if this carries on, it's going to be a massive problem.
Of the 500-plus people arrested at a Palestine Action protest on Saturday, almost half of them were over the age of 60. These people arrested on potential terror offences. Are you comfortable with Britain now being a country where pensioners get handcuffed for holding placards? Talk about that after 11. Plus, the mad sacrifices that young people are having to make just to pay the bills. A fifth of them now say they've stayed in a miserable relationship purely because they can't afford financially to leave. If you've been in that situation, want to hear from you after 12.
Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. This is LBC.
First tonight, it probably won't have escaped you that the news is absolutely full at the moment, isn't it, of stories about immigration and specifically about asylum seekers. We've had a whole raft of them, for want of a better phrase. We've had the ongoing protests outside migrant hotels. The news just this weekend that 50,000 people are on course to have come here on small boats in the year that Labour has been in power. Yesterday, we had a major announcement from the government about sending more criminals home to their own countries rather than making them serve their sentences today. A direct quote from the Justice Secretary, we'll send more of them packing. Then today, we had an LBC exclusive about another government policy, the news that Home Secretary Yvette Cooper is looking to stop more people using human rights laws as a loophole to avoid being deported. This, again, by a Labour government. Today, we also had, in case you missed it, the Reform Party hosting a press conference on women's safety, claiming that it's asylum seekers rather than the thousands, if not millions, of men already here abusing women who are the main problem. So what we've got, in short, I think, are the three main parties, Labour, the Tories and Reform, all desperately scrabbling around, scrambling over each other now, to try to see who can sound the most anti-immigration and who can sound the toughest when it comes to asylum seekers. And you might think that is long overdue, that this sort of crackdown on immigration is something you've wanted to see from our politicians from a long, long time. You might think this tough talk, this ramping up of the rhetoric about sending people packing and asylum seekers posing a major threat to women in Britain is exactly the right tone for the problem that we are dealing with. But not everybody agrees, to put it mildly. Today, more than 200 organisations, charities, trade unions among them, have signed an open letter to our party leaders, our political party leaders, calling on them to end what they call the pernicious and insidious currents of racism and hatred that is underpinning all of the conversation that we're having right now about migration and about immigration. They write this: the pernicious and insidious currents of racism and hatred underlying these protests are glaring evidence of a failing system. The responsibility to end the divisive politics, racist rhetoric, and demonising language of the past is yours. Only then will you bring unity instead of division and cohesion rather than hate. It's fairly unprecedented, this. More than 200 of these organisations saying enough is enough. Our politicians are fuelling racism, they are fuelling division, and they are fuelling hate by the way that they are talking about immigration and the way they are talking about migrants. And this is having real consequences. A video on social media this weekend of a man and a woman in the northeast going up to people who they suspected might be asylum seekers, demanding to know who they were, where they came from, and whether they'd been given a free phone. You look at the protests outside the hotels. I don't think it's that contentious to suggest that if our debate about immigration hasn't already become deeply toxic, then it's very much on the verge of becoming so. So are these organisations right to say enough is enough? Do you have concerns? Not so much about the policy, not so much about the numbers, but about how much we now talk about asylum seekers and about the way in which we do it. Do you worry that our conversation, our debate about immigration in this country, has become racist and demonising and divisive, to use the language of those 200 organisations? If you do, 0345 6060 973, if you have any of those concerns, you might think the exact opposite. You might think, what a load of, I don't know, woke do-gooding nonsense from people who are part of the problem rather than part of the solution. That actually, it's long, long past the time that we started to have a really serious, robust, and at times quite tough conversation about immigration into this country. That number once more for you tonight, 0345 600 973, to call or to WhatsApp. You can text me this evening on 84850, or if you've got an Alexa device, say, Alexa, send a comment to LBC. Do you worry, like these organisations do, that our debate around immigration has become racist and divisive? Let's talk to somebody who signed that letter. Rabbi David Mason is executive director of Hayas Plus J-Corp, one of the 213 organisations that have put their name to that open letter to our political leaders condemning recent anti-refugee protests. Great to have you with us on the programme, Rabbi. Thank you for coming on. How big a step is this? It's fairly rare that you get so many organisations like this speaking out. What do you make of it?
Thanks, Ben. It's good to be on your show. Good to be with you. I think this is a real, this is an enough moment. I think there's something here about a large group of organizations. We're actually a Jewish-based organization, based on Jewish values. We believe very strongly the Jewish values of compassion and responsibility mean we should give a fair go to people who seek their place here. My grandparents left Germany in the 30s, escaping Nazi Germany. There were people here that protested against them coming, and yet my family made a very good go of being part of British society. So, yeah, there's a moment now in which for a number of years, there's been a growing sense of demonizing of asylum seekers. It's bubbling. It's part of political discourse, probably finds its way, obviously, into the media and into society. It's part of, I suppose, a generation we live in where things are not easy economically, societally, for people across our country. So I think we feel together, and together with refugees, done great work in bringing over 200 organizations together, faith groups, unions, as you named it very well, and more. There's a sense in which it's enough. The political echelon has to think carefully about splitting between a mature narrative, where we can, a mature conversation, where we can talk about policies that create a fair system, a workable system, and fear, hate, and demonization, which really we should push away. We clearly should push away. They're not British.
And your view at the moment, Rabbi, is that too often the language that is being used by our politicians is what? Racist? Divisive?
But I think to say that everything that is said is racist, but I think, yes, at times it is, absolutely. But also, even if it's not openly racist itself, it can lead to those feelings in society. If you're going to criminalize asylum seekers, if you're going to make them look like they are threatening, that they're illegal, that they are they should not be welcome, then you also are going to open up that box, that tinder box of racial feelings towards groups that come into this country.
But, I mean, it is people listening to this, Rabbi, will say, well, it is the case that some of them are illegal, that they don't have the right to be here, and that some of them are threatening. Some of them are committing crimes. That's a fact.
So what we would say is create a fair, good system. At the moment, there isn't a fair system. People who are escaping, we support young people in my organisation, right? We have Jewish community people and others supporting young, unaccompanied asylum seekers who come from persecuted places, come here, and they face at every step of the way difficulty. So why not put a fair system in place? Yes, people will be returned if there is a fair sense they haven't met the criteria. No problem. But it also means that people who have proper claims for protection, who desire, need our compassion, will get support here. It often worries me that we are so simplistic. We talk about the boats in a negative sense. Yes, we'd rather people didn't obviously come over on boats. But at the same time, there are many people who are escaping persecution.
Yes, it's the tarring of all with the same brush that you object to.
Yeah.
This press conference reform today sort of insinuating that all, well, not insinuating, but leaving open the door to the idea that all asylum seekers are potential rapists.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. And therefore, there's a sort of blurring of facts or outright lies often. People are led to think things that really they shouldn't be thinking. We should have a proper law and order in our country. Absolutely, it does its job. But that should be something separate from racializing people in that context as well. We think that's really, really a problem. We think fairness is important.
I hear you, David. I guess the politicians in their response and perhaps in their defence will say, well, we're just responding to public anger. It's not that we are kind of the ones whipping this up. The country's had enough of the number of people coming here on small boats and so on. And we, as their elected officials, are responding to that robustly.
I think there is a great deal of responsibility with politicians. Politicians have to be careful. We remember, right, let's put it this way, senior politician, if I say it that way, talking about us being an island of strangers. That was our prime minister.
Yep.
He regretted that statement. We know that he said that, but it was still said. That itself can whip up a fear itself. That only has to be said, let out on the media, in society, and people will react to that. So you're right that government has to think about its constituency, think about its people across the piece. But I think the government also and political parties have a responsibility not to create hate, not to create division. We want a cohesive society. We want a neighbourly society where people think of their neighbourly responsibility. It doesn't have to be naive. It can be done in a fair, orderly way without criminalising.
Appreciate your time, Rabbi. Thank you very much. Indeed, Rabbi David Mason is the executive director of Hayas Plus J Corp, one of the 213 organisations that have signed the letter we're talking about tonight. You might be listening to this, by the way, shouting at your radio, saying, what a load of utter nonsense. Finally, politicians are taking the issue of immigration seriously, and here are a load of organisations telling them to be a bit nicer about it. That might be your view, and if it is, you know the number, 03456060973. Or you might share the views of David Mason and others, that even if we do need to stop the boats, and even if you think, as I do, that immigration has been too much in this country over the last 10, 20 years, there is a way of talking about it, and there is a way of dealing with it that doesn't fuel, as this letter claims, racism, division, and demonising of a whole group of people. And I'll be totally honest with you, I do worry that that is the road we've gone down. When you see people protesting outside hotels just because there are some asylum seekers there, when you see videos of just members of the public going up and confronting people with brown skin, accusing them of being asylum seekers, demanding to know how they got to Britain, when you've got major political parties giving press conferences for the first time, as far as I can see, on violence against women and girls, and not talking about the fact that most of it is carried out in the home, most of it is carried out by people who live in this country and were born in this country, but somehow inferring that the only problem is asylum seekers. I do worry about the tone that this has taken. It's not to say I don't want to stop the boats. It's not to say I don't want us to get a grip on immigration. I do. But can't we do that without demonising everyone who's trying to come here? Many of them with a legitimate right to claim asylum. So I do think, I actually think this letter is onto something. The debate, the conversation about this is becoming so toxic, dangerous, and at times, let's be honest, it's becoming violent. I wonder if you share those concerns or if you think it's a load of utter nonsense. Either way, give me a ring this evening. Take your calls on that in just a moment. Ben Kentish here on LBC. The time now is 10:17.
LBC. Here comes Steve with the satisfied smile of a man who's checking out at midday after a great night's sleep and a delicious unlimited brekkie. See the untamable bedhead hair, and if you look really close, you can see that properly well-rested glow, which can only mean one thing. Last night, he slept at Premier Inn. Get better sleep for your money. Premier Inn. Rest easy. Breakfast subject to availability. T's and C's apply.
The ASA regulates UK ads across all media, including radio, to make sure they stick to the rules. You should be able to trust the ads you hear, whether you love them or hate them. So we're by your side and keeping our ears open, because every little helps. The ASA, keeping ads legal, decent, honest and truthful. Oh, yes.
The people have spoken. Drivers have voted. And the Auto Express Driver Power Family Car of the Year is, wait for it, the Vauxhall Astra. Chosen for its design, drive and onboard tech. Get behind the wheel and experience the award-winning Vauxhall Astra Griffin Hatch or Sports Tourer today. Two models, one offer. Both £325 a month with £325 initial rental. Search Astra Griffin now. Personal contract hire and Astra Griffin 1.2 manual, hatchback or sports tourer. 48 months, T's and C's, subject to status and availability. You will not own the car, Stellantis Financial Services.
This is LBC with Ben Kentish. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
10:19 the time. Let me come straight to your calls. Do you worry that our the tone of the conversation we're having in this country right now about immigration is straying into racism and division? Or is that complete nonsense in your view? To James in Tower Hamlets this evening. Hi, James.
Hello. Good evening to you, sir. Mr. Kentish. How are you?
I'm all right, James. Thank you. How about yourself?
Well, let's cut to the chase.
Go on.
In terms of foreign national offenders, I've heard what Shabana Mahmood has said, that they're going to try and expedite deportations and they're going to one of the issues we have here. Okay, if you're a foreign national and you're convicted in a Crown Court and you receive a sentence of more than 12 months, mm-hmm. the judge will normally make a recommendation to the Home Secretary for you to be deported, okay?
Yeah.
Now, say you get a six-year sentence. Maybe it's for drug supply. A terrible conviction because these things do so much damage to people. So you get a six-year sentence, but you've been in this country 20 years.
Yes.
And you've not become a British citizen. You've stayed a citizen of the country that you came from. Maybe you've got a passport, which is not...
I hear what you're saying, James. So what you think...
You're a foreign national offender. Yeah. So as you're coming towards the end of your sentence, okay?
Yes.
One of two things can happen. You can get a letter saying you're going to be deported.
But what they're talking about doing, James, is not even sending people to prison here. So if you are sentenced to a crime, to a custodial sentence, rather than going to a British prison and then being deported when you leave, they will deport you straight away. And it's part of this.
I know what that's about.
Yeah,
okay.
I don't want to go too far down the kind of policy road here, because what we're having a conversation about this hour is about. It's about the language. It's about things like we will send more of them packing. It's about Labour letting it be known they want to crack down on asylum seekers' ability to use human rights laws. It's about Reform hosting press conferences about asylum seekers being a threat to women in Britain. It's about the Tories going on about how migration is a threat to our way of life. It's about the language that's being used by our political leaders in relation to these sorts of issues and whether you think it's strayed into, too often, racism and demonisation.
Well, I don't think it's straying into racism. In terms of foreign national offenders, the government want to cut down the use of Article 8 of the Human Rights Act. Okay, they're saying it's being misapplied.
Yeah.
So they're saying, right then, you get convicted of an offence, a serious offence, out you go, and serve it in the country that you came from, or somewhere like that. Now, a lot of FNOs, foreign national offenders, do rely on Article 8, but there has to be exceptional reasons why they shouldn't be deported.
So would you say, James...
I work in immigration, right. Okay? I know the score.
So would you say this is just a very sensible solution to a long-standing problem?
Well, I probably don't agree with it myself, okay?
Right.
Because if that happens, you're going to have a lot of immigration lawyers out of business, okay?
that's not necessarily a reason not to do it.
Let's talk about the real issue here. The number of people coming across the channel, which we know has gone up, right? Now, first of all, how many of them are genuine asylum seekers?
Well, it's about two-thirds on the base last time I checked.
So, right, well, what we don't see
mm-hmm.
is demographics, okay? Right. Where do these people come from? We don't know.
We do know, because the Home Office...
Because
the Home Office published the statistics.
The statistics can be made to say anything you want.
No, if you say to somebody, where are you born... And then you publish the figures of how many people were born in Albania and how many were born in Afghanistan.
Most people who come over on rubber dinghies do not have any ID, bona fide ID on them. They don't have passports.
That's not true. How do you know that?
It is true.
You just told me there's no data.
Because I'm involved in those cases.
You're involved in immigration, but you don't think they publish the nationality of people claiming asylum? It's on the Home Office website.
I don't trust the Home Office.
That's different to saying they don't publish the figures, because the figures are published. Which I would have thought, James, respectfully, if you work in immigration, you'd know.
Do people genuinely escaping persecution. Well, yes. They're in fear of their lives.
All right, we're going around in circles. Two-thirds of them are found to have... This was last year, I believe, so it might have changed slightly, but two-thirds last year had their asylum claims upheld and confirmed. So, yes, two-thirds of them were found to have legitimate claims for asylum. But I don't want this to become another conversation this hour about policy or how we stop the boats. Or I want this to be a conversation about the language, the demonisation, the fueling of racism. That's the allegation from these 200 organisations today, more than 200 of them. I'm interested in your thoughts on whether they've got a point, that you listen to some of the way that we talk about immigration here on LBC, you hear from our politicians, you hear the kind of national debate here on this radio station. Do you worry that it's got very vicious and very violent and very toxic? Or do you think actually this is just a country that's had enough and is finally confronting a problem that it shied away from for too long? 0345 606 0973. Appreciate the call, James. Thank you, sir. To Sharon in Westport this evening. Hi, Sharon.
Hello, Ben.
Evening.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right, thank you. Well, talk to me about this idea, this suggestion today that our politicians mm-hmm. are fueling a racist debate about immigration. Is that true? Is that fair?
Yes, I think it's absolutely fair. I wouldn't want to go down the route that the last caller did and link it to this business about deporting foreign criminals, because I actually think that's got some merit and is probably sort of quite understandable. But it's the whole thing about the language. It's not just the language that's increasingly being used by politicians, but it's language that for the last 30 years of my lifetime has been utterly unacceptable and beyond the pale.
And
which has suddenly become normalised. Yeah, I mean, I was a kid in the 1970s, right? And I grew up in a world where it was absolutely unacceptable to use pejorative terms about people of other ethnicities.
Yeah.
A world where gradually we were becoming more tolerant, less racist, less sexist, more tolerant of all kinds of people. And by the way, that was in Northern Ireland as well, which has been problems. And suddenly, and I think it is suddenly, and I link it back to an event that happened in the middle of the last decade, beginning
which was
with B.
Brexit. Yeah, the unsayable. Do you think, is that when it started, this kind of, this demonisation of immigrants, you think, Sharon?
I think that's when it became widespread. It opened a Pandora's box. It entered the national... I'm not saying that people weren't racist before that, because I think, I'm sorry to say it, but I think Britain's been a country for a long time with a lot of racist people in it.
There's always been racists around, but what you're saying is...
But we were trying to do something about it.
Yes.
People are not happy when they're racist. It's a state of... being racist is a state of fear.
But Sharon, what makes you think that our current, the way that we talk about immigration now is racist? Because a lot of people who are very passionate about this and very angry about the levels of migration would fiercely dispute the idea that it's racist to talk about.
Well, I think... In fact, I know that there's a set of conspiracy theories being promulgated on social media, and to some extent, they've sort of reached the actual media and they've reached the mainstream of politics, particularly, you know, even with the Conservative Party. And that is this, you know, these Islamophobic myths like the replacement theory and so on. And this idea that I've seen it. Well, you've seen it yourself, I'm sure, this utter nonsense about the people who are coming over in boats being sent over as some sort of like advance wave of an invading army.
Yeah.
It's all of this utter madness that's obviously being promoted by malign actors.
Yeah, it's not being challenged.
Well,
it's not just not being challenged.
Thing.
I guess the point these organisations making is, Sharon, it's not just not being challenged. It's actively being fueled by politicians talking about islands of strangers and promising to send more people packing, and Yvette Cooper today talking about clamping down on human rights laws. You've got Keir Starmer talking about an island of strangers. And that's the Labour side. Before you get to the Jemricks and the Bravmans and the Farages...
I mean, full disclosure, I'm a card-carrying, loyal member of the Labour Party.
Well, are you concerned by the language that some of your senior party leaders are using in this area?
I believe Keir Starmer apologised and rejected the Island of Strangers thing. I'm sure he deeply regrets it.
Someone in his team wrote that speech for him. Shabana Mahmood yesterday, we'll send more people packing. Yvette Cooper today, we're closing human rights loopholes. I mean, I say it again, this is a Labour government. You would not have heard Gordon Brown and Ed Miliband and Tony Blair talking like that.
No, you would not. You would not. I agree with you there. Yeah. But I think if fingers are being pointed at politicians, you just have to stick them squarely in the direction of Nigel Farage and reform.
But you can't,
and whatever he was before he was reform, the Brexit Party, fine. The UKIPs, before that, that's
But Sharon, if I read out, maybe I should do this at some point, if I read out a series of statements that Robert Jenrick, Keir Starmer and Nigel Farage have said about small boat crossings, I think you'd struggle to tell the difference at the moment.
I know, I agree with you.
Because there is this consensus.
But is it a consensus? I find that very hard to argue with. I don't think it's a consensus of conviction.
Well,
I think
no, it's of convenience.
I think wrongly, the mainstream of politics is sort of following the herd at the moment a bit.
Yes.
And that's why I texted in, and that's why I phoned in, because I very much agree with these organisations who've come up with this message tonight, and I hope they're listened to. Because at some point, the tide has to turn.
I don't think they will be, because the politicians have decided that the way to win the next election is by seeing who can be the most tough on immigration and talk the toughest about migrants. I think it's just going to get worse and worse and worse, Sharon. But I hope you're right. Thank you, Sharon. Sharon in Westport. And you're right, by the way. I don't think Keir Starmer and Shabana Mahmood and Yvette Cooper really believe this stuff. I think they are responding to Nigel Farage. But there are a lot of people, including a lot of Labour MPs, who say you don't respond to Nigel Farage by trying to by outmanoeuvre him to the right. Have those people got a point? Thank you, Sharon. Lots more to come on this in just a moment. And after the news, this.
What needs to happen today is that we together, the thousands of us, the journalists at Al Jazeera and our sister networks everywhere, that we need to continue to do our job.
Funerals held for the 5 journalists killed by an Israeli strike in Gaza yesterday, amid widespread condemnation from across the world. We'll get the very latest details, and we'll look at Israel's response and whether it holds any grounds to it at all after the news headlines. 10:31 is the time. Here's Matt Hewitt.
Sir Keir Starmer and the Canadian Prime Minister have both agreed that peace in Ukraine must be built with Kyiv, not imposed upon it. The joint statement comes ahead of Donald Trump's meeting with Russia's President Putin in Alaska on Friday. The funerals of 5 Al Jazeera journalists have been taking place in Gaza after they were killed in an Israeli strike last night. The IDF says it was targeting one correspondent, Anas al-Sharif, claiming with little evidence that he was the leader of a Hamas cell. And detectives in Kent are continuing to question 3 young teenagers on suspicion of murder after a man died on the Isle of Sheppey. The police and an air ambulance were called to Laysdown-on-Sea last night. LBC weather, the odd spot of rain for North Wales, Northern Scotland and Northern England tonight. Dry and mainly clear elsewhere. Lows from 13 to 19 degrees. A heat health alert is in place tomorrow across England. Highs of 34.
LBC. Nick Ferrari at breakfast.
Tomorrow morning with Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Reform UK says Britain is no longer a safe haven for women and girls due to the Channel migrant crisis. Do you agree? Plus, Trump says he and Putin will discuss land swapping at the Ukraine war summit this week. Nick will take a calls on that. And should the NHS do more to protect nurses? Nick will bring you the very latest. All that and more coming up with Nick Ferrari at breakfast tomorrow morning, 7 o'clock, here on LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Listen on your radio and on Global Player. LBC.
When we're little, we don't overthink things. We're brave, confident. We laugh and ask questions.
And play.
And play. So why stop there? Just because we're adults, it shouldn't mean we stop trying new things. For me, starting a career in early years has meant not just a new job, but new skills, new friends.
Like me.
Yes, and a new sense of purpose. All that, and I can earn while I learn.
Yay, painting next.
Do something big. Work with small children. Search early years careers to find out more.
With Little Plus Bakery Spin, simply shop and spin to win a free Little Bakery coupon on every shop. Download Little Plus and get a little bit more at the Retail Industry Awards Supermarket of the Year. 18 plus GB residents. Various prizes available. Subject to availability. Ends 20th of August. Full T's and C's apply. See little.co.uk/spin.
When you smile in.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Oh, bad traffic. Great news, isn't it? More time in the car. Joy. Maybe you don't feel it. Maybe you don't drive a Lexus NX yet. But when you do, you'll see the positive of peak hour. The delight in a detour. The love of the long way. The Lexus NX plug-in hybrid. Experience amazing before you arrive.
Ben Kentish on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
10:34 is the time. This comes in from Lloyd in Brighton. Evening, Ben. There is no language that is fueling racism. The whole country has had enough of the invasion that's clearly happening. They all need to go. People are worried about their children. Mass deportations must start soon. So there you've got Lloyd in Brighton texting into this show, as I'm glad you did, Lloyd, to insist there is no language that is fueling racism. Literally in the sentence before, talking about an invasion that is putting our children at threat, telling us they all need to go and demanding mass deportations. Lloyd, I think you've slightly contradicted yourself there, mate, haven't you? There's no language that fueling racism. They're all just all invaders that threaten our children. If you genuinely can't see how talking about an invasion and the threat to children and so on fuels racism, then that is evidence of just how far down this rabbit hole we've gone. And I said again, I'm not saying the small boat isn't an issue. Not saying it's not a problem. I'm not saying we don't need to tackle it. I'm not saying I don't want to see immigration come down. I do. But the language that we use matters. This is the sort of language that is exactly the sort of language that leads to that video this weekend of people feeling completely empowered to go up to a random brown person that they encounter on the street and say, are you an asylum seeker? How did you come here? Did the government give you a free phone? And I don't know about you, maybe we're on a different page on this one, but I don't want to live in a country like that. That is not the sort of country that I recognise, us being, where people of colour get accosted in the street by people demanding to know if they came here on a small boat. Where more and more now, politicians who are on course, if the polls suggest, to be our next Prime Minister, try and tell us that Britain was a safe haven for women and girls before the small boats started coming. Go back 10 years before the small boats became a real issue. How many sexual offences do you think were recorded in this country in 2015? Give you a guess. 103,614 in 1 year. Almost 35,000 reports of rapes. 768,000 reports of other sexual offences. This is the country that Nigel Farage thinks was a safe haven for women and girls. Well, he wasn't talking about them, was he? He wasn't banging this drum passionately in defence of women and girls and their safety back then. But as soon as asylum seekers are the threat, oh, yeah, it's outrageous, this is. We're not a safe haven anymore. We never were, Nigel. You just didn't seem to take much notice of it when the perpetrators were white. But suddenly now it's asylum, or a couple of asylum seekers that are accused of it. Suddenly, everyone cares about violence on women and girls. People, politicians, who had nothing to say about it at all for most of their careers, suddenly impassioned about violence against women and girls. Cynical. Desperate stuff. Really, really cynical stuff. I'll say it again. Forgive me for not thinking you are serious in your compassion for the safety of violence of women and girls if you've had nothing to say about it until you saw ability to link it and blame it on migration. 10:37 the time. Let's talk to David in Southampton. More about this language. David.
Hello. Yeah. I mean, this has got nothing to do with racism. These organisations are pushing the same old tropes and lies. They don't acknowledge the chaos these migrants are causing. They're causing chaos in our country and in communities.
What chaos are they causing?
They're just landing from outer space in communities, living in hotels, living in housing.
All right. What,
got no
what,
connection what, with anything.
That's not chaos.
They just bought their way into... They're going to cause chaos because they've got no way of connection to this country.
Right.
They're economic migrants.
Well, then two-thirds of them are found
over
to be...
the top.
Two-thirds of them are found to be valid asylum seekers, so they're
That's a trope and a lie.
It's not a trope,
because
it's a fact.
Yes, it is a trope because
it's a fact.
they
Might not like it, but it's a fact.
Yeah, it's a fact because they can't be deported. Because they can't be deported because you can't prove where they've come from.
It's not true.
That's the truth of it. You're pushing the same trope and lie.
You just said it was a fact then. Is it a fact or is it a lie?
It's a lie that you're pushing.
So the Home Office hasn't said that two-thirds of people who come here on small boats have their asylum claims upheld? Yes or no?
This is the most welcome country in the world.
David, yes or no?
Do you agree with that?
David, yes or no?
What's that?
Has the Home Office published data that shows that two-thirds of people who come here on small boats have their asylum claims upheld?
Yes, but they can't be deported.
So why is it a lie?
It's a lie because they can't be deported because they don't have documentation.
You just won't accept the fact.
You won't accept the fact. You and your lefty supporters push that trope and lie.
But you just said it was a fact.
To justify the chaos.
David, it can't be a fact and a lie. It's one or the other.
No, you're pushing that.
I'm not pushing anything.
Why you've latched onto that.
I'm giving you a fact.
You want to latch onto that basic trope being pushed about the two-thirds.
Am I trying to latch onto facts in this conversation, David?
No,
yes, I absolutely am.
They can't be deported.
So, okay, let's get this right. So you think people come here and they apply for asylum and the government says, well, because you haven't got a passport, we'd have no idea who you are, so we'll just grant you asylum. Do you honestly, hand on heart, think that's how it works? Genuinely?
They can't be deported.
No, but David, ask my question.
Problem.
Do you genuinely think the government gives people in this country asylum just because they don't have documents?
They can't be deported. That's the problem.
That's a separate issue.
You can't prove where they come from.
That's a separate issue.
They've got rid of the documents.
That's not why they're granted asylum.
Yes, that is why.
How do you know?
It's a trope that you're pushing it.
How do you know?
You've latched on to it. How can you prove it?
How do you know, then?
I know because that's what I believe, mate.
You know because...
Yes.
You know because it's what you believe. Why do you believe it? Because other people are saying. Who's saying?
You want to try and latch onto that basic
fact
that's being pushed.
Yes, I'm trying to latch onto a basic fact in a conversation, David, on your part, I'm afraid, that is completely devoid of facts. Because you might disagree, and I fear that you do, sir, but I still think we live in a world where facts matter. And you might not like the fact that two-thirds of asylum seekers two-thirds of people who come on small boats are granted asylum. You might think it's a sign that our asylum criteria are too lax. Fair point, if you think that's the case. But that's not what your argument, is it? Your argument is that it's not true, that it's a trope, that it's a lie. See, again, you're just coming out with conspiracy theories.
The migrants are causing chaos.
What's the chaos?
They're not... Look, they just come in, find their way in.
You're accusing me of coming out with tropes, and you are coming out with nothing else. You've got no facts, you've got no evidence, you've got absolutely nothing to substantiate. These claims that it's all a lie and they're causing chaos and this, that, you cannot back it up. And we're going around a circle, so we're going to move on. But I appreciate the call, as always. David, thank you very much indeed. Talk more about this in just a moment. I want to just turn for a couple of minutes, though, to other matters, important matters, elsewhere in the world. Widespread condemnation from across the world today after 5 journalists were killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza, intentionally. Israel says it was a targeted strike. One of them was an Al Jazeera correspondent in Gaza. Anas al-Sharif was his name. And lots and lots of governments, lots and lots of organisations condemning Israel for coming out and saying, yes, we were targeting him. They've accused him of being a senior Hamas operative. Let's talk to Ahmed Najjar about this. Ahmed is a Palestinian political analyst, playwright, who has written in The Independent today an article headlined, The Killing of Al Jazeera's Anas al-Sharif in Gaza is an Attack on Truth Itself. Ahmed, great to have you with us on the programme. You knew Anas in a personal capacity, I believe. Who was he?
Anas was my neighbor back home in Jabalia refugee camp. He was born and brought up in the same area where I was born and brought up. He was almost felt like a very close person to me as I was following him on social media and on Al Jazeera reporting the news daily. And particularly when the north of Gaza was cut off from communication, and he was almost the only person reporting from the north of Gaza. As if you may remember that when Gaza was cut off from the internet, so he was almost the only person reporting from the north of Gaza. I actually, before I got here about a couple of hours ago, I read his will. He wrote before he was killed, and it's heartbreaking, and it shows how determined he was to deliver the truth, how a truthful man he was to what he was doing, and determined. He knew Israel was after him. They threatened him not to stop reporting. But he refused to stop reporting and kept going, reporting on the Israeli war crimes and reporting on the genocide in Gaza. And the news about him being killed and his along with his colleagues was devastating, really devastating for the entire of the people of Gaza. And I would say is devastating for the world of journalism. Just bearing in mind that there are more than 200 journalists have been killed in Gaza in the last 2 years within this genocide. Which
Israel
is
obviously rejects the genocide charge. I mean, but let me just ask you about the claim from the Israeli government, the IDF, that Anas al-Sharif was a senior Hamas operative. They say he was listed on Hamas sort of membership and payroll documents and so on. There's photos of him seemingly hugging Hamas leaders and so on. Your response to those claims from Israel?
It's absurd, really absurd to think that he was. It's bizarre because why have they just decided to kill him now? He's been reporting on the news for the last 2 years, and I could even tell you where he was for. He was in the front of the camera more than he was off the camera. So just the question is, like, why did you choose to kill him now?
What evidence
do you have to kill him?
Let me just respond for that. The evidence that Israel says it has are, and it's sort of released these images that seem to show his
Excel
name.
Excel sheet, I've seen it.
They're fake?
It's the very same evidence that they released when they attacked the Al-Shifa hospital, which is a table that they showed.
Would you say it's been faked? Is that your view of it?
Oh, for sure. I mean, Israeli claimed that a two-year baby was a member of Hamas. So we know what Israel is doing, and I don't know why should we actually parrot the Israeli narrative. Look at all.
I'm not parroting it. I'm just asking you to respond to it.
No, of course. If we look at all international organizations and their position and what Israel is doing, they're obviously condemning what Israel is doing and have concluded in what Israel is doing is a genocide in Gaza. And let's not forget that the man who's saying this, or the country that's saying that Anas al-Sharif was a member of Hamas, is a genocidal state. It's a state that's committing the crime of the crime.
Obviously, that they reject that. Just on the other bit of evidence that's been sort of supposed evidence that's been put out, Ahmed, this image of former Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar with his arm round Anas al-Sharif, who is grinning in that photo. Do you know how that came about? Do you know how that came to be?
I don't know about this particular picture, but like I think we have to understand that Hamas was the government and was running Gaza, and the journalist would have relationship with those people who were running the Gaza. Assuming that you might have a relationship with the Conservative Party or
Conservative Party is not a terrorist organization, of course.
To you, Hamas is a terrorist organization.
Yes,
at that time, to the Palestinians, wasn't and is not. So at that time, Hamas was running. Hamas was the government. So to see Hamas having pictured with other journalists, it doesn't mean that they belong to Hamas or they are in line with Hamas. It just means that the journalist is trying to build up connections for interviews and for what have you. So I think that's a lame claim. The number of people I know personally who have pictures with leaders with Hamas is enormous. So it doesn't mean that they actually have anything to do with Hamas. For example, the founder of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmad Yassin, he has a picture with almost everybody in Gaza. So it really is doesn't like have
it
any.
You're saying it doesn't mean that he's a supporter necessarily or indeed a member. Ahmed, thank you. Good to have you on the programme. Ahmed Najjar is Palestinian political analyst, playwright, who has written in The Independent today. The killing of Al Jazeera's Anas al-Sharif in Gaza is an attack on truth itself. Lots of your calls coming in about whether you think the 213 organisations today warning about this country's debate on immigration and how it's become racist and demonising are right or not. Come back to those in just a couple of minutes' time. Ben Kentish here, and this, of course, is LBC.
LBC, this morning on Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Those mass arrests, the highest number before was believed to be 329. Those were the poll tax riots back in 1990. Here we are, 522, not quite double, but getting on for double. And there was virtually no violence.
I don't think I want to live in a country where holding a poster saying, I oppose genocide, I support Palestine action means you get arrested. Isn't that an overreach? In the instance on Saturday, I read that two of them were women in their 80s. Palestine Action are useful idiots to Hamas and Hezbollah and the terrorists. But simply holding a poster?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the new LBC app.
At TfO, we're opening up more of London for everyone with step-free access. We're continuing to improve accessibility at many of our stations, and now over 200 stations and counting have step-free access, including the entire Elizabeth Line, DLR and all tram stops. That is how we're making the greener way to travel more accessible to all. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Here comes Steve, with the satisfied smile of a man who's checking out at midday after a great night's sleep and a delicious unlimited brekkie. See the untamable bedhead hair, and if you look really close, you can see that properly well-rested glow. Which can only mean one thing. Last night he slept at Premier Inn. Get better sleep for your money. Premier Inn. Rest easy. Breakfast subject to availability. T's and C's apply.
With over 50 years' experience at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
Save this summer with Lidl Plus. Get 2 for £7 on burgers, jumbo sausages and more. And get 2 for £3.50 on our plant burgers, veggie sausages and more veggie classics. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this summer today.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/lptv. Offer ends 27th of August.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Ben Kentish on LBC. Text 84850.
10:51, Dima, I'll come to your call in just a moment. Let's have a quick look at what's leading tomorrow's newspaper front pages just before we do that. The Metro, first of all, 11 attacks a day are being carried out on nurses in A&E who report they are being punched, kicked at, spat at and threatened with a gun and even acid as they try to care for patients. The same story on the front of the Mail. A&E waits fuel 4,000 attacks on NHS staff a year. Wonder how many of those are carried out by asylum seekers, eh? You listen to our politicians, all these attacks on women and girls are being carried out by migrants. Wonder how many of those 4,000 were carried out by asylum seekers. As a guess, very, very few. Talking of a debate on immigration that might have turned toxic, here's the Daily Express front page. 550,000 migrant boat arrivals under Labour. Sir Keir Starmer was blasted last night after Channel migrant arrivals under Labour surged past 50,000 in record time. And the Times, last but not least, looking ahead to that summit between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin on Friday. We'll talk more about that in the next hour. Trump, I will try to get Ukraine some land back, is their front page headline. Right, to 10:52 the time. Back to your calls and our conversation about whether you worry that our debate on immigration in this country has become racist, divisive and demonising, as 213 charities, trade unions and refugee organisations today tell our politicians that it has. Who do they blame? They blame the politicians. They've told them to rein it in, to dial down the rhetoric. Have they got a point? To Dima in Rochester this evening. Hi, Dima.
Hello. Hi.
Hey.
Hi. I think I wanted to call and say that I feel like the media and sometimes as well politicians at a high level are not aware really how radicalized young generations in this country have become against migration. If I were to report to you the atmosphere in the university I graduated in, and I mixed a lot with, for example, political societies, conservative and labor, and sometimes I hear like 80% of them believe in the idea of free migration. They believe that most immigrants take out of the system than they put in. They believe most of them have come to claim benefits when a lot of immigrants actually have full-time jobs here. And I think it's become so hard to really be public about your identity as an immigrant in this country. For example, I've lived here for 10 years, but I've noticed in my career as of late, because my career takes me to remote villages and towns in this country in the oil and gas sector, and having to hide my identity a little bit.
As in, what you're having, when you said identity, you mean you're having to hide the fact that you weren't born in this country?
Yes, and the fact that I come from Iraq, or the fact that I'm a Muslim, I don't look visibly like any of these things, and I feel like, oh, I'm lucky, I can get away with blending in. And it's a worrying development for me. And I worry about the people who don't look like they can blend in as easily as I do.
And this is a new fear? And this wasn't something you worried about when you came here, but it is something you worry about now?
Yes, absolutely. When I came here, the atmosphere was so welcoming. I lived in Newcastle. Everyone was so nice. You didn't feel any hostility. You could truly describe the society as the most tolerant in the world. I don't know if I can say that now for a lot of the remote towns and cities in this country. And I don't know who to blame, really. I just think those who live in London, for example, or if you're near a centre of power, you're really not aware of just how radicalised and racially fractured communities in this country have become.
What do you fear would happen if you were open about having come here as a migrant from Iraq?
A lot of them would have perceptions and ideas about what I think, what I believe.
Right.
For example, actually, one of my landlords told me you're one of the good ones. And then he asked me, what do all these people who we see in the videos in the Middle East attacking people or, engaged in terrorist activities, what do they do all day? And I had to clarify to him, these are not the majority. These are a very small minority and problems that we're all trying to control and solve. Of course, extremism, terrorism is a problem in every society. And I think right now I feel is a bit of intolerance, but run it 25, 30 years into the future, you are going to see a lot more violence. The intolerance is going to turn from discussion to violence.
I think we're seeing it already, aren't we, in some of these protests that have turned violent and so on. Dima, it's heartbreaking to listen to you, to be honest. Sorry that that's the country that we've become. Somewhere where hardworking Iraqi migrants making their living here feel they have to hide where they've come from. Because we've become so intolerant. People who came illegally, by the way, presumably, rather than illegally. But still, everybody's tarred with the same brush, aren't they? When they talk about immigration in such negative terms, it doesn't matter how you came there because people don't stop to ask. Thank you, Dima. Thank you for the call. Isn't that not heart-wrenching? This is where we are going as a country. Let's talk to Yasha in Barnet about it. Oh, hi, Yasha.
Hi, Ben. I'm an immigrant myself, not with both, though, student visa. But the point I'm making is journalists supposed to point out the problems and politicians should find out about the solution. But it's the other way around now. Robert Jenrick, Nigel Farage, Labour government are only just pointing out the problems without any solutions. And you, journalists, and us, citizens are looking for the solutions. If they can stop the boats, happy days. We're all going to be happy.
I don't think people would be, Yasha, because if they stop the boats, then people, and this is already happening, would start to turn their attention on the people already here. This is what shifted. We've gone from having a conversation where we all agree people coming across the channel and the numbers they are on small boats is a bad thing. We need to stop it. Fine. Agreed.
Absolutely.
We've gone from demonising anybody who came here from anywhere that isn't Europe, basically.
Correct. They can't stop the boats. The problem, the solution is integration. These people are coming. Someone called Vanessa Feltz yesterday saying there are many asylum seekers sitting in his local park all day. And he doesn't feel safe to send his kids to the park. And I agree. That's absolutely.
But why are they sitting in the park not doing anything, Asha?
Because the government and the councils and the government don't do anything about these people.
It's because they're not allowed to work. So they have to hang around the parks because they can't work. And then people say, why aren't they working? As if it's their fault.
They should go to English classes. They should go to, classes like life in the UK. Integration, that's the point. If you have nothing to do, you go to, you go outside, find someone who can speak your language.
Yeah. What, you think it's on, it's on them to learn English? I agree. But the idea, people say, why are they all dossing around? Why are they all sitting around parks all day? Because they're banned from working, and the government takes a year or two to process their claim. So what do people want them to be doing?
Exactly. That's the point I'm saying. The government, the councils, and the Department of Work do nothing about these people, and they have nothing to do, so they go to the park.
Yeah.
That's the only thing they have to do.
And then they get accosted by people demanding to know where they came from and how they got here and did they get given a free phone. I mean, it's really depressing. We have gone... this is my worry, Asha. That we've gone from a conversation, an important conversation about numbers and policies and how we clamp down on certain people coming here and how we reduce the numbers overall, to a conversation where basically immigrant equals bad or asylum seeker equals dangerous. It's so reductive, and yet because of the language that a lot of our leading politicians are using, that's where we've ended up. Got to leave it there for now. We're going to move on after news. Thank you for wrapping up our conversation, Yasha. Other matters in the news today. The Palestine Action arrests at the weekend, over 500 of them. It's reported today that almost half of those arrested were 60-year-olds, nicked and handcuffed just for holding placards. Does that bother you in any way?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, Israel says it has more information than it's publicly released, confirming that the correspondent it killed in an airstrike yesterday was a terrorist. The IDF claims Anas al-Sharif was earning salaries from both Hamas and the news network Al Jazeera. It called the killings of him and four other journalists a blatant and premeditated attack on press freedom. The funerals have taken place in Gaza. Blake Sifton is LBC's correspondent in Tel Aviv.
Anas al-Sharif was probably the most famous journalist in Gaza. He had some 500,000 followers. On X, he was widely respected, widely watched. Just last month, there was warnings that they may target him. So when I heard this news this morning, it was not a surprise.
Downing Street says peace must be built with Ukraine, not imposed upon it, after Donald Trump confirmed the country's president won't be invited to talks between him and Russia's leader. The US president says he'll call Volodymyr Zelensky instead after Friday's meeting. A court ruled that a former PE teacher at a private school in Edinburgh exploited his position of trust for almost 30 years to abuse young boys. John Young sexually and physically assaulted pupils at the Edinburgh Academy from the 60s onwards. The 91-year-old was deemed medically unfit to be tried. A Labour peer is calling for a statue of a British imperialist to be removed from outside the Foreign Office. Baroness Thangam Debonair says visiting Indian citizens and dignitaries should not be forced to walk past the memorial to Robert Clive, who paved the way for the British Raj. Alan Lester is Professor of Historical Geography at the University of Sussex.
He extracted, in today's terms, about £10 million a year for himself as a personal grant derived from the taxation of Indian subjects. And at the time, it was noted that this rapacious plunder of Bengal was certainly an exacerbating factor in the deaths by starvation of around 10 million people.
Cristiano Ronaldo has announced his engagement to long-term partner Georgina Rodriguez after 9 years together. She shared a photo on social media of a large diamond ring on her finger with the caption, "Yes, I do, in this and in all my lives." LBC weather, the odd spot of rain for the northern half of the UK tonight. Dry and mainly clear elsewhere. Lows ranging from 13 to 19 degrees. That rain fizzling out tomorrow to leave blue skies almost everywhere. A heat health alert is in place across England. Highs of 22 to 34 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Matt Hewitt.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ben Kentish.
It is 11.03, Ben Kentish here with you. As always, this time of night here on LBC. Very good evening if you're just joining me here on the programme. You probably would have seen by now the news of the mass arrests of protesters, activists in Parliament Square over the weekend. We now know that in total, 532 people were arrested after a protest in Westminster in support of the prescribed group Palestine Action, which you probably remember was prescribed as a terror group a month or so ago by the Labour government. We now know as well that of those 532 people currently arrested, almost half of them were aged 60 or above. Almost a fifth of them, over 100, were in their 70s. And the vast majority, all but 10 of those arrested so far, were nicked, handcuffed for displaying a placard in support of a prescribed organisation. That was it, holding a placard. And if you've seen the photos, what those placards say is along the lines of, I oppose genocide, I support Palestine Action. Those were the placards. And for holding those placards, 522 people, including loads of pensioners, have been arrested. In some cases, they face serious charges. They will face potentially offences that could result in custodial sentences. And I'm interested in your thoughts between now and midnight on whether you have any issue with that at all, whether that sits uncomfortably with you, whether that makes you a little bit uneasy when you hear those figures, that we are, and this is a fact, not an opinion, we are now a country where you get arrested, where pensioners holding placards gets you locked up and potentially charged with terror offences if those placards say, I support Palestine Action. When you hear that, when you see those pictures, when you hear those figures, do you just shrug your shoulders and go, well, if you don't want to be arrested for terror offences, don't go and sit in Parliament Square expressing your support for a prescribed terror group? Because you would be well within your rights to conclude that, I think, that these people absolutely had it coming. In fact, in many cases, I suspect they went down there exactly to get arrested. It was that sort of direct action protest. But I can't help but think, as much as I disagree with Palestine Action, as much as some of the things they've done absolutely appall me, I don't know if I want Britain, the Britain that I sort of love, actually, and know, to be somewhere where just holding that placard gets you arrested in the numbers that were on Saturday. I don't. When I ask you whether it makes you uncomfortable, I ask that because it does make me slightly uncomfortable. Do I think they should be prescribed? Tricky. Do I think just expressing a support from a placard is a terror offence? I don't know. I don't blame the police here, by the way, because they are just enforcing the law as they have to do. But you tell me, do you have any issue at all with people in their 70s or their 60s sitting silently, holding a placard that says, I support Palestine Action, being arrested on accusations of supporting terror? 03456060973. Does that make you in any way uncomfortable? Do you see any problem with it whatsoever? Or do you think it's the right approach? That these people are accused by the government of targeting Jewish-owned businesses. They've taken RAF jets out of action by breaking into air bases and spraying them with paint and so on. Do you think, well, they've got what's coming to them by being prescribed? And people who want to openly support them even after they were prescribed should fully expect to be protested, fully expect to be arrested. And the police are just doing their job here. Or does it make you a little bit uneasy? And if it does, why? 03456060973. How do you feel about a load of pensioners being arrested, handcuffed, hauled away by police for silently holding a placard in Parliament Square? 03456060973 is the number for your thoughts on that. You can WhatsApp the very same number, as always. You can text me this evening on 84850. Do you have a problem with it, put simply? Do you have a problem with what happened at the weekend? Let's talk to somebody who does. Sean O'Grady is associate editor of The Independent, who's written a piece today headlined Arresting Hundreds for Protesting Against a Ban on Palestine Action Shames Us All. Sean, very, very good evening to you. Why does it shame us all?
Because it's ridiculous. And it's so ridiculous, it's shaming. I mean, these people, there was an Oxford professor of poetry, for example, there was some, well, Sir Jonathan Porritt is an environmental advisor to Prince Charles. These people are not terrorists, and to call them terrorists really devalues the term terrorism.
But no one's saying they're terrorists. People are saying they are accused, and, you know, the pictures are there, of expressing their support for a prescribed terror group, which
That's right.
they were.
But it isn't a terror group. It is prescribed, but it's not a terror group. Terror group is what London went through on 7/7. It was 9/11. It was what Hamas did on October the 7th. It's what the IRA bombing campaign was all about, striking terror but killing people in you know, vast numbers sometimes. Those are terrorist organizations. Those are the things that should be prescribed. Those are places where, to a very large extent, people express support for them, like hate preachers, that sort of thing. They can be prescribed, they can be restrained, they can be detained.
And breaking into RAF bases or targeting Jewish-owned businesses in a violent way, that doesn't class as terrorism? Because the government says it does.
I don't know if Palestine Action is doing that. There are laws...
definitely broke into an RAF base, Sean.
Well, that's right, but that's not quite the same as what you just said, which would be a very much a racially motivated...
That's what Keir Starmer said, that they have target Jewish-owned businesses.
Well, I don't know so much about that, but if they have done that, then they should be prosecuted. The organisation should be prosecuted, or the people who commit those crimes should be prosecuted in the normal way.
Right.
But it isn't exactly the kind of terrorism that the public would understand, and it isn't what these people have been protesting about. These people are basically protesting about what's happened in Palestine, and we all know what's happened.
There's lots of people who have been protesting against what happens in Gaza without expressing their support for a prescribed group, and those people could have gone on the march, they could have held Palestine flags, they could have said we oppose what's going on in Gaza.
They could have
done all that, and they wouldn't have been arrested. So, I mean, there is an argument.
They might if they said or did certain things. I mean, according, if you tell it to the radical right, they think if you wave a Palestine flag around, that means you're supporting Hamas.
But most people don't think that. That's certainly not how the police operate.
I hope so.
But there is an argument.
These people support an organisation that took action. I mean, the most high-profile act, and the reason why they got proscribed, in fact, was the attack on some RAF planes with some... paint, which did them some damage. You can have a law, we've already got a criminal law, you could augment it by making it especially severe on people who damage military equipment, air bases, naval dockyards. We used to have laws about arson that would leave you being hanged from the gallows. You could introduce such laws, you could do that. Mm. But to call them terrorists for what they did to the RAF planes, at any rate, that's not sensible. So the fault is in the law, the Terrorism Act 2000, and the way in which Yvette Cooper's chosen to apply it, and just under political pressure. It's entirely unnecessary. It devalues the term terrorism, which because they're not supporting the slaughter of innocents, they're not supporting Hamas. Nobody says they were doing that. That's not what why they got arrested. None of them will end up in jail because the DPP won't bother to prosecute them in the public interest because it would take too much time and it would be futile. So that's the whole thing is a complete mess.
I hear your point about whether or not they should have been prescribed, Sean, and there obviously was a lot of concern at the time in line with what you're saying. But given that they have been, and it was made very clear that they were, anyone who chooses to sit in a public place directly expressing their support for them should be arrested and should expect to be arrested.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if I go around dropping litter because I believe that the litter laws are wrong, and I'm doing that, and at some point I'll probably, not be immediately, but anyway, at some point I get arrested, I know what I'm doing. They knew what they were doing.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that the law is the right law. That's the way in which you protest against a law, which is what they're doing.
But it's not necessarily, because they could have sat there in Parliament Square with placards that said, I oppose the prescription of Palestine action. And that wouldn't have got them arrested, because that's the argument you're making on national radio. But they didn't do that.
Hold on.
Sorry. They weren't expressing, they weren't just expressing their opposition to the ban, which is very legitimate. They were directly expressing their support for the group, which is very different.
No, not necessarily. Not in the hands of some clever lawyers. I mean, they could say that if you were saying that, you were in fact expressing indirect or whatever support for the group and its actions, and then it would go into court, and the judge would have to make a judgment about whether you do, whether that constituted support. Well,
if those placards had said, "I support Hamas," I think most people would understandably infer that that meant that they supported what
Hamas
does.
They didn't. That's my point. They said they didn't say that.
No.
That's the whole point. I mean, if you take the other guy who was arrested for holding up the quip from Private Eye, which was to the effect that unacceptable Palestine action, acceptable the Israelis committing war crimes in Gaza, or words to that effect, was that expressing support? And if it was, why isn't the editor of Private Eye in his lot in a jail cell somewhere?
That's far less clear cut. But the people who were directly expressing, I mean, I support Palestine action. I don't really know how much clearer that could be in saying I support Palestine action.
I agree with you, but it's a double one. Because, one, they're saying they support Palestine action, but they're doing it in such a way as to attract arrest, which is the point, and make a fool of the law. And they're actually protecting against the law, or at least against the law as it's been applied by Yvette Cooper, because it's unnecessary and it's practically futile.
But then why didn't they just say...
Palestine are not understood to be terrorists.
But they are in the eyes of their law.
Sense.
So if they wanted to actually just protest against this, they could, as I say, I go back to the point, they could have had placards that said Yvette Cooper was wrong to prescribe Palestine action, or Palestine action
shouldn't have
been prescribed.
But that wouldn't have allowed, that probably, although you never know, because it depends on how the policeman interprets
it. Wouldn't have got them arrested.
Because they might have got arrested, but my point is that wouldn't have attracted an almost certain arrest, which was their aim.
Right.
You know what I mean? That was what they set out to do.
In which case...
To make the point that the law is foolish.
In which case, we shouldn't have much sympathy for them, should we? Because they set out to be arrested, and shock horror, they have been.
Well, not at all, because you can set out to be arrested for all sorts of things if you want to, make a sort of political point about it.
Only if you're breaking the law.
Lots of people do that. Sorry?
Only if you're breaking the law. If people set out to intentionally break the law, then the sympathy we should have for them for being arrested is limited.
No, but you can't. You've got a right of dissent. You've got a right not to obey laws and face the consequences.
Yeah, which just includes being arrested.
Because you're not an automaton. I mean, when we had the poll tax riots, and lots of people resented the poll tax because it was so unfair, and they refused to pay their community charges, it was called, in 1990 or so.
Yep.
And they were sent summonses and sent lawyers' letters and all the rest of it, and the people who demonstrated, some of them quite peacefully, but they could have ended up in a court or kept in a police cell for the night, more likely. That was because they hated the poll tax. The whole country pretty much hated the poll tax. Got rid of the Prime Minister. You don't have to obey every law. You're allowed to dissent from it.
Sure, but there will be... Exactly, but there will be consequences. And I think if people are intentionally setting out to incur those consequences, then to an extent, my sympathy is limited. Thank you, Sean. Interesting conversation. Appreciate your time tonight. Sean O'Grady, Associate Editor of The Independent, who's worth reading his piece, Arresting Hundreds for Protesting Against the Ban on Palestine Action Shames Us All. The Sean Wright. This is just we've gone fully down the rabbit hole. We've completely lost the plot. When a bunch of academics and pensioners and God knows whoever in their 60s and 70s are being arrested for holding a placard and sitting silently in a square in London. Does that bother you, that we've sort of crossed a Rubicon somewhere here? Something a little bit, if not very authoritarian, draconian, about the way those people have been treated? Or do you just think, well, you might not like the decision, to prescribe Palestine action, but if you want to go and openly express your support for them after they were prescribed, well, that's entirely on you. Don't be an idiot. Don't be so stupid. Of course you should be arrested. 0345 600 973 is the number to call. Loads of your calls coming in on this. More of those to come right after this. 11:17.
This is LBC.
The people have spoken. Drivers have voted. And the Auto Express Driver Power Family Car of the Year is, wait for it, the Vauxhall Astra. Chosen for its design, drive and onboard tech. Get behind the wheel and experience the award-winning Vauxhall Astra Griffin Hatch or Sports Tourer today. Two models, one offer. Both $325 a month with $325 initial rental. Search Astra Griffin now. Personal contract hire and Astra Griffin 1.2 manual hatchback or sports tourer. 48 months, T's and C's, subject to status and availability. You will not own the car. Solantis Financial Services.
At Pension B, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionb.com and be pension confident when investing your capital is at risk.
All those glasses are a great choice. And now you can pick a free pair from our Boots range.
Free?
That's right.
What, free?
Absolutely. There's hundreds to choose from too.
For free? Does the manager know?
I am the manager.
Oh, in that case, how do these look?
With buy one, get one free at Boots Opticians, everyone can save in style. Book an eye test today and see what's possible. Free Boots pair when you spend £150 on prescription glasses or sunglasses. Offer ends 23rd of September 2025. T's and C's apply.
With Little Plus Bakery Spin, simply shop and spin to win a free Little Bakery coupon on every shop. Download Little Plus and get a little bit more at the Retail Industry Awards Supermarket of the Year. 18 plus GB residents, various prizes available, subject to availability, ends 20th of August. Full T's and C's apply. See little.co.uk/spin.
Ben Kentish on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Let me come straight to your calls. Do you have any sympathy for the people arrested at that Palestine Action protest at the weekend? Do you feel any discomfort about 532 of them being arrested, the vast majority just for holding a placard, over half of them over the age of 60, a fifth of them over the age of 70. Although someone here makes the point on text, why does it matter what their ages are? If you commit a crime or you're accused of committing a crime, you should be arrested. To Rich in Solihull first on this evening. Evening, Rich.
Hi, Ben.
Evening.
Thanks for talking to me. I find it absolutely confusing and slightly amusing that, I mean, I do fundamentally agree with you that you know, they knew what they were getting into. They held up the banners supporting a prescribed terrorist organisation. I think that what happened had to happen. But the right-leaning media and certainly the Murdoch-owned newspaper, The Times today, took the angle of, you know, what on earth's going on here? This is the end of free speech. You know, you can't even hold up a banner saying I support this, and, you know, in silence without being arrested. But had that protest happened and you know, 500 or 600 people had been sitting there in Parliament Square with banners supporting a prescribed terrorist organisation, and zero arrests had been made, they would have been the first people saying, what on earth is going on here? You know, why were there no arrests? But I mean, that, you know, you've got newspaper, right-leaning journalists doing this, people on your own radio station saying, you know, what's going on? We can't arrest people just for holding up a banner. Had no arrest been made, there would have been uproar. I mean, this is
but
just...
But also, that argument, I think, is nonsense, Rich. The idea that, I mean, if how many of us think that if someone stood in Parliament Square with a banner saying, I support ISIS, they shouldn't be arrested? So I don't think it's about...
Should.
No, exactly. So we, most of us would agree on that, wouldn't we? So I don't think it's about free speech here. I guess the issue that a lot of people have is the fact that Palestine Action have now been put in the same legal category as the likes of ISIS and Hamas and Al-Qaeda.
I think it was wrong that they were prescribed in the first place. And I think that was pandering to the kind of reform agenda. And I think Labour are generally looking over their shoulder at the moment, not at the Conservatives, but at reform. And I think it was done for that reason. But my fundamental point is the right leaning media uses as an opportunity to say free speech is being closed down when had nothing been done and the Metropolitan Police had just allowed them to raise those, then there would have been uproar. The same journalists would have been saying, how can you hold up a placard supporting a terrorist organisation and not be arrested?
Yeah.
Absolute political point scoring.
The police you can disagree with the law, and plenty of people do, but the police have to enforce it as it's passed by Parliament, is what you're saying, Rich, really.
They do, and I don't think Labour can win, really, because, I mean, they have no influence over the Met, but had the Met done nothing, then it would have been a left-wing conspiracy, what are these people doing, they're supporting it. And then the moment that they get arrested, suddenly it's the end of free speech, and you've got people like J.D. Vance who are saying that, the UK are closing down free speech.
Yeah, I hear you. It does. Yeah. I think it will rankle people, though, that if your phone's nicked or your bike's nicked or you're burgled or, something happens to you in that domain, then the chances of a Met officer turning up are pretty slim. But if you sit if you sit in Parliament Square with a placard, then dozens of them will be there to arrest you. That will get people's backs up, potentially.
For certain, but I think the whole thing was choreographed anyway, because I think the Met knew they were going down there. And I think they went down in huge numbers, and there were processing centres down there for them. So it was just the writing was on the wall as soon as they'd gone down.
Yeah, Rich, I think you're spot on. What alternative did the Met have in that case? But again, you go back to your point, is the law right in the first place? Even if we say the Metropolitan Police are right to enforce it, and you say no. Thank you, Rich. Great call to kick us off. Jordan's in Chelmsford on this tonight. Hi, Jordan.
Good evening. How are you doing, right?
Yeah, I'm good, Jordan. Thank you. How are you, sir?
Fed up.
Fed up? Go on. What's up?
We are coming to a very, very, very serious tipping point, in my opinion, where all of this about, this side, that side, this, that and the other. We've spoken many times, of course. People are fed up and people have had enough. And something in terms of a decision needs to happen.
And decision on what?
To stop the death and destruction that's happening within Gaza, etc. Yeah, enough is enough, and I despair.
What do you despair at?
The indecision from our government, from higher powers. Nothing is changing
about in Gaza. It's just getting worse.
No, that's one point, right? Let alone everything else. Nothing is changing, and people are so angry, which is making me extremely nervous.
They are. But what about Palestine Action? Do you think those people in Parliament Square, sitting there silently with placards saying they support that group, was it right for them to be nicked?
You guys are extremely intelligent. I don't think you should be asking this question. They're a prescribed terrorist organisation, so you shouldn't be asking that question, should you?
What, because it goes without saying that if you expressed your support for a prescribed terror group, you should be locked up or arrested?
Come on, mate.
Even if you think they shouldn't have been prescribed in the first place?
Look, they're a prescribed terrorist organisation. Why are you questioning that?
Well, because we're within our rights to question the government and question the law, Jordan. That's a democracy.
They're a prescribed terrorist organisation.
As of about 4 weeks ago.
Why are you questioning that?
Why shouldn't we question it?
Why are you questioning it?
Because that's free speech. And it's
The decision's been made. Why are you questioning that?
Right, so we shouldn't question any decisions the government makes. We should just sit there nodding along and just going along with it.
A prescribed terrorist organisation, and you're sympathising. Yeah,
I'm not sympathising. I'm not expressing a view on whether they should have been prescribed, Jordan. I'm saying people are absolutely within their rights to question it and oppose it if they want to.
Why
aren't they? Because why should people object to anything the government does?
What do you think about?
Do you want us to be North Korea? Where nobody
what do you
dares
think about
criticize.
October the 7th?
And it was an absolutely appalling pogrom of Jewish people, and the worst since World War II. Carried out by a brutal terrorist.
Why are you questioning the decision from the government?
I'm not. I'm asking what people think.
You are. You should accept it, but you're not, are you?
Why should I accept it?
You can't answer it,
Jordan,
can you?
There's a difference between saying you agree with it and you accept it. If you say, look, you know, it's fine to question the decision, but you think it was the right one, completely fair. But what you're saying is nobody dare question the government's decision on this. Which
they're a prescribed terrorist organisation. Right, you can question it.
Yeah, we're going around in circles, Jordan, because you're saying the same sentence over and over again. Appreciate the call. Be helpful if you actually engage in the conversation and we can have a back and forth. Yes, I know I'm questioning it because that's what we do. That's what the media does. That's the whole point of the media, is to question and challenge and scrutinise what people in power do. And if you want to live in a country where everybody just says, well, the politicians know best and we'll just go along with everything they say, then you should probably move to Pyongyang and see what Kim Jong-il is up to, because that's not the country we live in and not one that I want to live in personally. Appreciate the call, Jordan. Thank you very much. Henry is in Cambridge this evening. Hi, Henry.
Good afternoon, Ben. Evening, sorry.
Evening, sir. It's a bit late for that. You all right?
Yeah, so I will start off and say that I think the conversation we're going to have is going to be a lot less hostile than the one you were just having.
Hostile is all right. I don't mind hostile. It'd be nice if we could actually have a conversation rather than just saying the same sentence over and over again and not engaging.
I think it's a bit too late for hostility.
Go on, Henry. You talk to me. What do you think?
Okay, so I'll start off with the main point, but I do want to carry it on to something else, and you'll see what I mean.
Okay,
so,
go on.
I do follow the same line of thinking as you, as morally and ethically, is it right that they got arrested? Mm. Absolutely not. However, I do agree with you when you say that if you bring a placard that is directly provocative to the law, because effectively that's what they're doing, and yep. I'm glad that they're doing it, and it's a good thing, but can I be surprised they're arrested? No, because obviously that is in clear contravention with the new law. Now, I think that there does kind of need to be a middle ground, because the rhetoric from the left and the rhetoric from the right, it's got us stuck in this revolving door. And the only person that really gets, well, the only side that gets their opinion heard is who can shout the loudest and in most numbers.
Right.
Now, I used to work in the civil service within the justice system. So I have some kind of insight as to the laws and my personal opinions on them. I don't think that the ECHR, which was written in 1952, I believe, is no longer suitable to the problems we face today. What I will say is similar legislation, I can't remember exactly what it is, but the Misuse of Drugs Act.
Mm.
Now, that was written at a time when the whole purpose of the punishments that were given was a deterrent. It wasn't necessarily to relative harm. It was purely a deterrent in against doing it. Now, what people think of the drug laws, that's a whole different situation. The point I would say, which I think would be a good middle ground, is to go, the current legal framework that we are working around with this issue, the ECHR, isn't fit for the current problem that we face.
Right. But if you disagree with certain legal frameworks, Henry, what I think what we're agreeing on is you can protest against the law, but if you choose to break it, then you should expect the consequences.
Absolutely. Yeah. And maybe I've thought too much and had too long of a line of thinking. Because
you can never think too much.
With this one, I think you can.
Appreciate the call, Henry. I absolutely hear what you're on about, and I think you're right. You can protest against the law, but if you choose to protest against that law by deciding to directly break it, well, you can't really say it's outrageous I was arrested, can you? Thank you, Henry. Lots of your calls to come on this in a couple of minutes' time, and...
Our capital city has been overtaken by violent gangs and bloodthirsty criminals, roving mobs of wild youth, drugged out maniacs and homeless people, and we're not going to let it happen anymore.
Donald Trump takes the major step of deploying the US National Guard to Washington, D.C. in an attempt to crack down on crime and homelessness, this by sending in the military. Is he doing that for the right reasons? Or is this another step down a pretty authoritarian path? Ask an expert about that. After news headlines, 11:31 the time, here's Matt Hewitt.
Israel says the media are ignoring its claims that a journalist it killed was a terrorist because he denied it. The IDF says it has more intelligence than it has publicly released, confirming that Al Jazeera's Anas al-Sharif was being paid by Hamas in Gaza. The EU says Israel should provide clear evidence.
Downing Street says peace must be built with Ukraine, not imposed upon it, after Donald Trump confirmed the country's president won't be invited to talks between him and Russia's leader. The US president says he'll call Volodymyr Zelensky instead after Friday's meeting. And get lost is one politician's response to Donald Trump taking control of the Washington DC police force and putting reservist troops on the city's streets. The US president says the murder rate is worse than Bogota, Colombia and Mexico City. LBC weather. The odd spot of rain for the northern half of the UK tonight. Dry and mainly clear elsewhere. Muggy, lows not falling below 19 in the south. Blue skies almost everywhere tomorrow. Highs of 22 to 34 degrees.
This is LBC.
You're driving down the back roads of Tuscany. The sun's setting. The wind's in your hair. You're playing your favourite tunes. No, not that one. Much better. Could life be any sweeter? Of course it can. With the money you saved by comparing car hire prices through Kayak, you've got more to spend on some fresh, creamy gelato. Mmm, we'll take due scoops, per favore. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
If I need an eye test, I don't go to Specsavers.
One thing you won't see at Specsavers is me.
Do I go?
Yes!
I mean, no. Me, I don't go to Specsavers. Nor you, eh, Spike?
Should have gone to Specsavers. Nah.
Hi, Specsavers. Here for your eye test.
They come to me instead.
Come in. Kettle's on. Oh,
thank you.
If you can't go to Specsavers unaccompanied, we could come to you. See if you're eligible at specsavers.co.uk/home visits.
Save this summer with Lidl Plus. Get 2 for £7 on burgers, jumbo sausages and more. And get 2 for £3.50 on our plant burgers, veggie sausages and more veggie classics. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this summer today.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears. Give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with Ben Kentish.
11:34 is the time. You listen to Ben Kentish here on LBC. This comes in from Anne-Marie. Ben, I'm so ashamed of this country. Arresting people who are having a peaceful demonstration is abhorrent. This government is protecting Israel, who are killing thousands of innocent people in Gaza. It's unbelievable. Well, I hear your point, Anne-Marie. But peaceful protests can still be illegal. If they were holding signs, I say, I'm going to go back to the same example that said, sitting there in silence, peacefully holding a sign that says, I support Al-Qaeda. It's peaceful protest, isn't it? Sitting there peacefully, doing nothing more than holding a placard. Do many of us think they shouldn't be arrested? Then if you are, if Palestine Action are a prescribed group, and they are, then what is the alternative? There's no point prescribing a group if you're not going to act and arrest people who will then knowingly express their support for that group. Is there? It's not so peaceful as well. If you are expressing your support for a group, directly expressing your support for a group that carried out millions of pounds of damage to RAF planes, that has violently targeted certain businesses, it's not quite so peaceful because you are indirectly advocating, effectively, for a group that carries out violence. So you might be peaceful, but it doesn't mean your support or your action is indirectly, if you see what I mean. What do you think? 03456060973. Come back to your calls on that very, very soon indeed. Just for a couple of minutes, though, let's turn to the big announcement from Donald Trump this afternoon that he is deploying the military, the National Guard, to be precise, to Washington, D.C., in order to get a grip, as he put it, on crime and homelessness in the city. He made that announcement during a news conference this afternoon and said the city's police will also be placed under federal control.
I'm announcing a historic action to rescue our nation's capital from crime, bloodshed, bedlam, and squalor, and worse. This is Liberation Day in D.C., and we're going to take our capital back. We're taking it back under the authorities vested in me as the President of the United States. I'm officially invoking Section 740 of the District of Columbia Home Rule Act. You know what that is? And placing the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department under direct federal control.
He said also that he will give homeless people a place to stay that is far away from the US capital. Let's talk about all about Andrew Feinberg, White House correspondent for The Independent. Very good into you, Andrew, or afternoon, I suspect, where you are. I mean, a lot of people listening to this on this side of the Atlantic might say, well, he's seen a problem with crime. He's sending in the troops to sort it out. Sounds like a good idea. Why is this a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal because this authority that you heard him talk about, the D.C. Home Rule Act, has never been used before. And when it was put into law, when the District of Columbia, the American capital, was given limited home rule, the right to elect a mayor and city council and make its own laws and such, that provision was put in with the idea that the president could request the use of the D.C. police force in the event of civil unrest. This was done in 1974, not that many years removed from the riots that took place after the assassination of civil rights leader Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And so the idea was that were there similar riots to break out, the president could bring the police under federal control if the city government lost control of the city. That has not happened. What has happened is there have been some isolated incidents that have involved people who the president knows or has heard about. There's a well-publicized incident involving a young former staffer of Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency who intervened in a carjacking and was assaulted. There was a former Trump administration official who was tragically murdered last year. There was a stabbing of a congressional staffer. But these are all isolated. And on the whole, violent crime in D.C. has gone down over the last couple of years.
So if the suggestion is he's misusing powers that weren't supposed to be used for this purpose, what do you think he's up to, Andrew, if he's not genuinely about sorting out crime?
Well, he talks often about being for law and order. And in this case, I think what he wants is order or the appearance of it. He wants the police to be more aggressive. He wants the homeless people cleared out from the Capitol. He saw some homeless encamped during the drive from the White House to his golf club the other day, and he became very upset about this.
But not on behalf of the homeless people. He just doesn't want to have to look at them.
Exactly. Right. And so it's the idea of order, in particular, a certain social order that he wants to maintain, the appearance of this social order. And it's not a small thing that the D.C. mayor is a black woman, the police chief is a black woman, and he has cut them out of the picture here and has put in charge the Drug Enforcement Administrator, who is a white man. And he complained during his press conference that the D.C. police had some persons on the force, either in the ranks or in leadership, who, in his words, shouldn't be there but got in because of woke, which is basically Donald Trump code for there are non-white people and women who maybe shouldn't be there because they're woke.
So we'll
because
send
that's
the
what
troops.
He sees.
I mean, it's
yes, exactly.
The idea of sending the army to round up the homeless is, I mean, it's so you look better and the capital looks better to visitors. I mean, it's sort of straight out the authoritarian playbook, Andrew. It's far more reminiscent of something you would have seen in a fascist dictatorship in the past.
Maybe, but it's something he's had a desire to do since 2020,
sure,
when he had those street protests, those racial justice protests that really derailed, yes, in some ways, his reelection campaign. And this has been a fantasy of his.
Is it unprecedented in U.S. sort of political history, this sort of behavior?
Taking over the District of Columbia Police Department, it is unprecedented because it has never happened before, yes. Yeah.
And then just a word, talking of Donald Trump press conference, you've been talking as well about this sort of highly anticipated meeting with Vladimir Putin on Friday. What's the latest on what he and the White House are saying about that?
Well, the messages are mixed, and they keep getting more and more mixed. There was talk that perhaps President Zelensky of Ukraine would be invited. Now he's not going to be invited, but the president has said he'll talk to him before, he'll talk to him after, he'll talk to European leaders before and after. And there's this idea that Ukraine may have agreed to the possibility of land swaps with Russia. Zelensky said, no, I can't do that without the permission of my government. This upset the president, President Trump, quite a bit. And it's not clear what the goal is, but it's giving a big win to Putin. It's letting him back into sort of the echelon of world leaders that get a sit down with an American president. And Donald Trump wants him to demonstrate a commitment to peace. But as he knows, because in fact his wife has told him, Putin may say one thing, but then he bombs Kyiv the next night.
Mm. Absolutely. Thank you, Andrew. I appreciate your time tonight. Andrew Feinberg, White House correspondent for The Independent. John gets in touch. Why do you give Trump the time of day? Because he's not some bit part shouty crank, John. He's the most powerful man in the world, the president of the United States. And just ignoring him isn't going to make it go away. So of course we're going to talk about what he's saying and doing. It has massive consequences for all of us. Thank you again, Andrew. Right, it is 11:43. Let's come back to our conversation about Palestine action. 532 people arrested in Parliament Square this weekend for expressing their support for them. Quite a few of them, in fact, the majority, were over the age of 60, some over the age of 70. Do you have any issues with them being treated and arrested in that way? Kevin is on the line in Birmingham tonight. Kevin.
Good evening, Ben.
Evening.
Yes, I do have issues with people. It's not necessarily because of their age, because obviously there's plenty of people under the ages of 60 and 70 protesting, people of all ages. But I do take your point. And could I say first and foremost that I do agree with you about the technicality of the legal issue of expressing support for a prescribed organisation. I think you are absolutely right about that, and I think not enough people understand that.
Okay. So what do you have an issue? So you don't have an issue with them being arrested, Kevin. So what do you have an issue with?
Well, actually, I do.
You do? Okay, go on.
Yeah, I do, because people have to remember that. I think it's a question of proportionality. So somebody sitting there, regardless of their age, somebody sitting there with a placard, almost regardless of what it says, if they're not breaching the peace, if they're not causing harm to anybody else, then actually I think it is disproportionate to arrest them and to charge them with an offence of terrorism when they're not actually causing anybody to be in fear of their life or harming anybody.
But isn't expressing support for violent terror groups indirectly harming lots of people, Kevin? Indirectly.
It would be if they were doing that, but as far as I know, they're not. But having said that, I've got to admit that I think there's some information that the general public have not been privy to, things that were not disclosed in court. So, I do respect the judicial process. So I think I have to be careful about being definitive about this, because I'm guessing that there are some things that organisation have done that they should certainly not have done.
Well, that's
and
the
it's
suggestion.
Not just about spraying paint on a plane.
Yes. That's the suggestion from the government that there is more sinister actions behind it. I think you're onto something really interesting, Kevin, which is whether we need to draw a line between people who express support for really some unpalatable groups and do nothing by way of acting on it, and people who do act on it. I wonder if, I use that example of somebody simply saying, I support ISIS, but not, not actually acting in that way, simply just expressing a support for, in that case, really violent jihadist terror group. Should that be a crime? Or is supporting something, even if you don't act on it, is that a kind of thought crime in a way?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because it goes to the issue about freedom of not just expression, but freedom of thought. And
if someone sat there saying, a sign saying, I support the Nazis, I support Adolf Hitler, I support the KKK.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to argue that they shouldn't face some consequences, but you might also say, well, actually just expressing a support for an organisation isn't a criminal matter. I don't know. It's a tough one.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there is a comparison with recent protests. I know this is slightly going off the point, but I, although I don't have any eyesight, my hearing is very good, and I do listen to things on the internet. Mm. And with some of the recent protests about asylum seekers, I've been listening to some far-right, I would call extremist people on the far-right, marching around, chanting things, including, and these are the exact words that I remember hearing, if they're white, that's all right. Yeah. If they're black, send them back.
I wonder if that would come under hate crime. Maybe someone who's a lawyer or a police officer can get in touch. Those sorts of racist chants that Kevin's talking about, and I've heard them too, Kevin, are they criminal matters? Because actually being racist isn't, is it? Saying something very, very racist, unless I think you are acting on it, there's an extent, there's a line at which it becomes illegal, but it often isn't. I wonder what you think of that. If you express support for a terrorist group, prescribed terrorist group, but you don't do anything by way of acting on that support, you don't join them, you don't give them money, you're not recruited by them, you just say, I support X group, should that be a criminal matter at all, whether it's Palestine Action or Hamas or Al-Qaeda? It has to be, doesn't it? Doesn't it? 11:48.
LBC, this morning, on Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Those mass arrests, the highest number before was believed to be 329. Those were the poll tax riots back in 1990. Here we are, 522, not quite double, but getting on for double, and there was virtually no violence.
I don't think I want to live in a country where holding a poster saying, I oppose genocide, I support Palestine Action, means you get arrested? Isn't that an overreach? In the instance on Saturday, I read that two of them were women in their 80s. Palestine Action are useful idiots to Hamas and Hezbollah and the terrorists. But simply holding a poster?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the new LBC app.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Ta. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you? Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
Here comes Steve, with the satisfied smile of a man who's checking out at midday after a great night's sleep and a delicious unlimited brekkie. See the untamable bedhead hair. And if you look really close, you can see that properly well-rested glow. Which can only mean one thing. Last night, he slept at Premier Inn. Get better sleep for your money. Premier Inn. Rest easy. Breakfast subject to availability. T's and C's apply.
Chase is the digital bank that puts you first.
What does that mean?
Well, most people don't bank 9 to 5. That's why Chase customer support is available 24/7.
So I can contact them whenever works best for me.
You got it. Mm. You can chat to a real person through the app.
That's handy.
And you can always call up to speak with them directly.
Hello. Now we're talking.
Join the UK's number one bank for customer satisfaction. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. Claim based on YouGov UK Banks and Building Society's rankings 2024. Verify at chase.co.uk/YouGov.
Mickey could try to sell his car privately. Or get it sold today with We Buy Any Car. He could spend days on end trying to sell to a bunch of time wasters. Or sell in a flash and head to the fun fair with the kids. Proper gutted. Or proper impressed. To get a quote in 30 seconds, enter your reg number now at webuyanycar.com.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with Ben Kentish.
Interesting question, that, isn't it? If you don't think that people should be arrested for expressing opinion, then isn't just expressing your support for even a terror group, is that not an opinion? If someone says, I personally support ISIS, it's an opinion, isn't it? I think it's an abhorrent one, a disturbing one. Should that be a crime? Because right now it is. Even saying I support Palace on Action is a crime. This comes in from Jay, which is perhaps a reasonable point in response. The important point is, Ben, if someone supports a group but doesn't act on it, it doesn't mean that someone else might not be influenced by them and then go on to act on it. So if you sit there saying, I support the KKK, even if you don't act on it, if you inspire somebody else to join and become a participant and so on, then you have indirectly still sort of benefited them in a tangible way, which I guess is why the law's there in the first place. But we are effectively talking here about people being arrested, potentially charged, potentially even sent to prison for expressing opinion, an opinion in support of a certain group. I wonder whether you have any issues with that in principle, or do you have issues with it in practice specifically when it comes to Palestine Action? Naji's in Hendon tonight. In Hendon. Funny that, Naji. Hi.
Evening, Ben. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you, Naji. What do you reckon? I mean, it really ties my mind in knots, this one, because I instinctively think free speech is important, but then I also instinctively think that, you know, arresting people for supporting terror groups is a fairly obvious thing to do. What do you think?
Yeah, well, you're going to like this. I'm going to disagree with the bulk of what almost of your all of your previous.
Oh, we love it. Go on, Naji. Go on, hit me.
I think all of your challenges to all of them were spot on. I've expressed to you before, I think, that I agree with the principle, as you say, behind banning Palestine Action, even if I had some misgivings about the practical issues bound up with it.
Right.
But with that said, it's not at all accurate for your callers to kind of reduce this debate to the effect of free speech and that these octogenarians were arrested simply for holding a placard. When given how many strong views you can have every which way on the war in Gaza, you have near complete freedom to determine what you write on that placard.
Yeah.
And on that, I completely agree with what you said. I think two or three calls before last, if someone had scrubbed out those last two words on that placard and written instead that they support Hamas, as indeed actually allegedly happened on another placard videoed at the protest, we wouldn't be having this same debate if they were octogenarian. You know, the thrust of the objection is not to the age of the protesters, it's to the content on the placard those protesters are holding up of their own free volition.
To sort of just come back to where this conversation's kind of ended up, Naji, which wasn't naturally where I expected it to go when we started it, the idea that just expressing support for a group, just expressing an opinion, saying, I like this group, I support that group. Should that be a legal criminal matter, or is that an impingement on free speech if you don't act on it?
No, I think your caller was spot on in terms of the consequences and the blowback it can have in terms of influencing people to then express support and then possibly act on it. But even then, I think it's secondary. I think that, you know, the point of strong disagreement we're seeming to have in this debate is not even on that question, should the law kind of be reformed.
Right.
We seem to be disagreeing even on the simplistic questions of whether the offence of expressing support as it stands, like applies even to slam dunk expressions of support on a placard. And I think we need to walk before we can run. If we can't even accept the law is factually being applied correctly in such simple situations, I think we need to think on that long and hard before we can actually argue the law is ripe for reform in some way.
So would you say it's almost a ridiculous debate whether somebody saying I support Hamas should or shouldn't be arrested? Because the answer to you is very clearly, of course they should be.
Yeah, it's plain as night follows day, Ben. I think I would sympathise with much of what people were saying in criticism of all this in terms of, you know, rabbit holes and the like, if people were arrested for simply protesting what they would call genocide in Gaza, and I wouldn't agree with them. But if the protests worldwide and in response to this war have shown anything, they've shown that you can have thousands of different ways in your own discretion to voice your opposition to the Gaza war.
Mm.
And that can't be more perfectly demonstrated than, you know, have they only written the first three words on their placard.
Yes.
Or even if they'd written that they'd opposed genocide and just opposed the ban, or said that
exactly.
That
if they said, "I oppose genocide, I also oppose Palestine Action being banned," I suspect none of them would have been arrested because that wouldn't be a criminal matter. But they didn't.
Completely.
Yeah, I hear you. Naji, I'm with you completely. Thank you very much indeed for the call. To Karen in Chippenham. Hi, Karen.
Hello, Ben. Good evening.
Evening.
Well, like you, I'm also tied in knots about this because obviously terrorists should be arrested. They should be tried and brought to justice.
Mm.
The problem with this incident is that, well, the main problem, it's no longer clear what the UK government means by the word terrorism. Are they really suggesting that Sir Jonathan Porritt and a bunch of retired academics and professionals protesting against the engineered starvation of children and babies in Gaza is a threat to life?
Karen, but let's go back to Naji's point. That's not what they were protesting about. They weren't just saying the first bit of the placard, there's no issue with, you might disagree with it, I oppose genocide. The bit that got them in trouble, legal trouble, was expressing their support directly for a proscribed group. Nothing to do with Gaza, really, in that sense.
Yeah, when it gets to that stage, clearly there are some people, you know, deliberately trying to provoke the government. But the thing is, I do follow the news and I look at all the different channels on the television and I try to understand it. But I'm confused because I know there are so many people now across the UK protesting against what's being done in Gaza. But, you know, it's difficult for all of us to know which are all the different groups, what their names are, which ones are designated to be sort of peaceful and which aren't very peaceful. But what all of this is now doing, it's taking people's attention away from the very serious issue of Benjamin Netanyahu's obsession, which he shares with the Hamas terrorist organisation, of blocking the two-state solution proposed by the Oslo Peace Accord in the 1990s.
Right, and all of the stuff that you've just said, absolutely people should be free to say and agree and disagree with. But when an organisation has been proscribed, and when it's been widely covered, it's been proscribed, and when people go down to Parliament Square with the express purpose of trying to get arrested for supporting it, knowing it's been proscribed, I'm afraid my sympathy with those people, whoever they are and whatever their age, is pretty thin, because they wanted to get arrested or they wouldn't have been there. So I'm not going to go and have a sleepless night over, you know, wringing my hands because they were arrested, because that was their choice. Appreciate the call as always, Karen. Thank you very much indeed. Pat in Gravesend can have a final word on this one before we move on. Hi, Pat.
Hello, how are you doing? How are you keeping? Yeah, the people getting arrested at the weekend are humanitarians, basically. If you lock them up, they will become prisoners of conscience. Really, they won't change their mind. I mean, they would do it for Ethiopia, Sudan, any country where they're sort of starving babies.
But that's a point. How many protests have there been about what's going on in Sudan in the last year?
Well, I'm sure it's going on. But groups doing it, it's just not highlighted so much as the issue of Gaza.
People don't care as much about the people of Sudan or the people of the Congo or the people of the other war zones in the world as they do about Gaza.
Indeed, but as I was going to say, the reason why I was thinking you could get rid of this legislation, if you could badger, the people get 40 or 50 Labour MPs or Kip Malthouse, Conservatives, whoever strong about the issue, get them to stand with the protests and they'll be arrested. Say 40 MPs arrested at the weekend.
They're not going to do that because they're not complete idiots.
That caused a constitutional crisis.
No, you can't they'd just be locked up. They'd just be arrested, whoever they are.
They have a mandate, and their constituents may agree with that.
Well, they might, but if an MP chooses to break the law, Pat, then they'll be arrested just like anybody else.
But the law can be wrong. In a democracy, you have every right to be wrong. Yeah. In a democracy, that's why we're in a democracy.
Yes.
You have every right to be wrong.
Yes, but we come back to where we started. You have the right to protest against the law.
Well,
you don't have the right to break it without there being consequences.
Okay, let's change it. Last weekend, there was a UVF march in Northern Ireland. It went through, it was a parade, they called it a parade. They should tell these people, not a protest, tell them not to go on a protest, it's a parade. The UVF marched through, the UVF band marched through. They're a prescribed organisation, nothing done, nothing said about it. You can look this back up or get your research.
I'm not familiar with that, I'll have a look at that part. Thank you for raising it. But what you're talking about here is a double standard, really. The double standard in how certain groups are treated. I can't comment on that exact event because, Pat, I haven't seen it. But thank you very much again for the call, Pat. Wrapping up our conversation from Gravesend in Kent. Right, we're going to move on the other side of the news at 12 o'clock. Want to talk to you about a couple of stories in the news today about the enormous difficulties facing young people financially and what they are having to endure or miss out on in order to cope. A fifth of young people. So they've stayed in a relationship that was unhappy and miserable because they simply couldn't afford financially to leave it. If that is you and you have ever been in that situation or know somebody who has, give me a call this evening, 0345 606 973. Talk lots more about that after this.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight, the funeral's been held for five journalists who were targeted by an Israeli airstrike in Gaza on Sunday night, with the UN saying the killings were a grave breach of international law. Anas al-Sharif was the best known amongst them for his work on Al Jazeera, but Israel insists he was a terrorist. Palestinian political analyst Ahmed Najjar says it's strange timing from Israel.
He's been reporting on the news for the last 2 years. I could even tell you where he was.
he was in the front of the camera more than he was off the camera. So the question is, why did you choose to kill him now?
The IDF says it obtained current intelligence indicating that Sharif was an active Hamas military wing operative at the time of his elimination. Al Jazeera strongly denies this. Nurses are facing abhorrent levels of violence in casualty departments, including being punched and spat at. That's according to the Royal College of Nursing, who say more must be done to protect NHS staff. Figures gathered from around three quarters of A&E hospitals reveal 4,000 violent incidents last year. The government says it's providing security training and emotional support. Donald Trump's confirmed that Volodymyr Zelensky won't be present at his meeting with Vladimir Putin in Alaska at the end of the week. The US president says he will call Ukraine's leader straight afterwards instead. George Barros is Russia team lead at the Institute for the Study of War. He told LBC Mr. Trump's focusing on an aspect that won't in itself end the conflict.
It sounds like President Trump would like to do some sort of territorial swap, which might be not terrible for the Ukrainians to accept. But look, Putin is requesting that Ukraine cede the entirety of a province as a prerequisite for only then getting to discuss Putin's war termination.
40,000 people will be trained as construction workers at 10 technical colleges across England. Some will be new, others exist now but will get more funding. Ministers say the centres in cities including Derby, Exeter and Leeds will reduce reliance on foreign labour. And jellyfish have shut down four reactors at France's largest nuclear power plant. The swarm entered the pumping stations at the Gravelines site near Dunkirk, causing an automatic switch-off. LBC weather, the odd spot of rain for North Wales, Northern Scotland and Northern England tonight. Dry and mainly clear elsewhere, lows ranging from 13 to 19 degrees. That rain fizzling out in the morning to leave blue skies almost everywhere. A heat health alert is in place across England. Highs of 22 to 34 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Matt Hewitt.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ben Kentish.
It's 12:03 Tuesday morning. Ben Kentish here with you on LBC. Very, very good morning to you for just joining us here on the programme. A couple of stories in the news tonight that I want to get your thoughts on because I think they tie in with each other. Let me give you the first one, first of all. Young adults are having to stay in relationships that they are unhappy in because they simply cannot afford financially to leave them. One in five people aged between 18 and 40 are choosing to live with a partner just to make living costs more affordable, according to a new survey by the ISA provider One Family. 21% of them say they've made that decision. 21% of that age group in a relationship that they don't want to be in because they can't afford to leave it. If that is you, or it's been you, or it was you, or maybe it's somebody you know, pick up the phone, would you? Talk to me about what on earth that is like. Living with someone that maybe you can't stand. Maybe they cheated on you. Maybe it's all gone south. It's an absolute disaster. You're desperate to leave, and you can't. You can't because you just can't afford to pay the bills. What is it really like living with a partner that you can't get away from because of financial reasons? What is it like? Maybe living with your ex. Maybe you did break up. Maybe you divorced. But you can't afford to actually leave the house because you both rely on each other for the rent and the mortgage. So there you are stuck. Day after day, week after week, maybe month after month, even year after year. If that resonates with you in any way, 03456060693, that's question one. If you've been in that situation, if you've had to stay with a partner or stay living with a partner who's an ex for money reasons, tell me what that was like for you. Was it a nightmare, as I'm sort of making it out to be? Or was it actually fine? You know, you stayed friends, you broke up, you carried on living together because it made sense and you started seeing other people. I don't know. 03456060973. There's another story there, which I think kind of chimes with that one that I just mentioned to you. It's been revealed this morning that university students would have to work 20 hours a week just to meet the living costs of doing a university degree. And those two things combined just make me wonder about the sacrifices that young people are having to make, the pains that they are having to endure because of their financial situation, and what that is doing to their youth. So if you are youngish, And I'll leave that open to interpretation. And you listen to this morning and you're thinking, actually, I had to give up so much of my youth, or what I thought my teenage years, my 20s would be about, because of cold, hard cash and the fact that I didn't have much of it. What did you have to give up? What did you have to endure? Maybe somebody had to do two or three jobs just to pay for your degree. Maybe just to pay the rent, you had to give up ever seeing your friends or going out, having a life. You had to give up a hobby. Maybe you had to give up a relationship because you couldn't make it work financially. So two questions there for you. First question, and this is what I'm really interested in your thoughts on. What is it like not being able to leave a relationship because of money? What is it like having to live with a partner or a former partner because financially there is no alternative for you and them? 03456060973, the number. But also on what that kind of suggests, the difficulties that younger people are having to face because of the cost of living crisis, because of the fact that so many young people struggling to get decent paid jobs these days. Was your youth all you expected it to be? Or was it tarnished, ruined even in some way, because of money? If you had to drop out of your education, if you ended up living somewhere completely different to where you always thought you'd live or wanted to be, miles away from your friends and family, maybe you had to give up on the dream of children. If so much of what you dreamed your young, if your teens and your 20s would be like when you were younger, failed to materialise because of money, and instead you ended up living a life that was incredibly difficult for that reason, pick up the phone, 03456060973. Would love to hear from you in the next few minutes or so. Get your calls coming in now. Let's talk about all of this first with Lucy Beresford, who's a psychotherapist and broadcaster. Lucy, great to have you with us this morning. This story about young people having to stay with partners who, you know, they don't really want to be with because of money. Are you seeing this in particular in your own work, the fact that the only thing that's keeping some people together in their relationship is cash?
That's right, very sadly. And I would actually hazard a guess that it isn't just the younger generation, the Generation Z that we often talk about, under 29. It's actually right across the spectrum, because it isn't just about the fact that you might not be able to afford the rent and therefore you don't know where else you're going to live. But even people who are married, people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, they look at the cost of divorce. They look at the cost of maybe having to have two households, for example. And they're either saying, right, I'm going to have to just tough this out, because financially, financial security is obviously a very important part of our mental well-being. So at least I'm going to be attending to that. But there was some quite interesting research from Ashley Madison, which is the married dating website people. They asked their members, you know, have you ever come across this scenario? And I think that was on the back of the fact that disputes in divorce have hit a 15-year high, according to the Ministry of Justice.
Legal disputes, rather than the
exactly, disputes, yeah, where you've got, that's actually also going to be very contentious and more expensive. Mm. And so, what Ashley Madison discovered was that quite a few people are going onto their site to have an affair because, in a way, it's a cheaper option, and you also may gain emotional fulfillment as well. So you're kind of making sure that your financial security is not compromised, but you're also trying to do something about getting your emotional needs met, whereas there may be other people who don't take that choice and are being dragged down emotionally, both because of the finances and also because they're in a relationship where they're desperate to get out.
Well, this is it, Lucy. It just sounds thoroughly miserable. The breakdown of a relationship, whether it's a marriage or whether it's any relationship, is difficult enough. But knowing that you literally can't afford to end it or to leave it, is intolerable, presumably, for a lot of people. Unbearably tough.
Absolutely. And you asked me what it's been like to sort of witness that. I have worked with several people whose it has been the major aggravating factor of their mental health because they have the financial trauma of feeling impotent, feeling trapped, feeling like they can't make autonomous choices in their lives. And they're in a relationship which is making them miserable, which, of course, isn't exactly a great recipe for improving your relationship, because you're arguably both very miserable. And what you really need is some time apart. And we saw this a lot in COVID, of course, where couples, for whatever reason, maybe they hadn't been in a relationship for very long, or maybe they had been married for a long time. All of the external energy that you can bring to your relationship by hanging out with your friends and going to your workplace and being stimulated in lots of ways, that was denied to so many couples. And it really added to the strain of COVID, of the pandemic.
And there's all sort of, I've heard stories anecdotally as well of people breaking up, but then because they can't afford to pay the rent individually, staying living together, often for years and years, while they kind of, you know, they meet new partners and so on. And it gets really complicated because they're basically both living with their ex. I mean, it's a recipe for disaster, Lucy, I guess.
It can almost always be a recipe for disaster, but there are some couples who do make that choice, particularly when children are involved.
Yes.
It is definitely the case that you can have a very amicable divorce, and it is better for the children in the long run. But in the short term, some people do worry that splitting the family up, having separate homes, can be very traumatic for children. And therefore, maybe if daddy could sleep in the spare room, and if mummy and daddy can be seen having breakfast together every morning, that somehow that might be a way to paper over the cracks. But actually, my clinical experience would suggest that it just doesn't last for that long, because as you pointed out, the grown-ups want to be moving on with their lives, and what that often means is finding a new partner, and how you then introduce that into an equation when you're already still cohabiting with your soon-to-be former partner is incredibly complicated.
Yeah, and it's very hard to move on in that circumstance. I guess people do make it work. The sort of younger people element of this, the people who aren't, perhaps it's not about the kids, it's just about the rent and the bills, and they can't afford to move out from the place that they're cohabiting. I mean, another story, Lucy, today about the sort of how much work young people are having to do just to pay for the university fees and so on. Do you think that we're sort of making it so difficult now to be young? We're asking young people to sacrifice so much. Do you see that with the young people that you work with, that that the cost of living is in some ways destroying their youth?
What an intriguing way of putting it. I have been very struck by how many people under 25 are seeking me out to have therapy. So
right.
That would be the first thing. So it's almost as if 25 is almost like the cutoff date where you think, gosh, I'm really struggling here, and nothing seems to be going right. I've reached my quarter of a century already, and my life isn't where I thought it would be. So people are paying attention to how they might improve that, and I think that personally, I think that's a good thing, that they will explore that. But at the same time, I think there is a lot of hopelessness out there. And I was musing on this over the weekend with some friends, because one of my big theses is that Generation Z, anyone in their 20s, is probably going to live to 110, maybe even 120 with medical advancements going the way they are. And then in a funny way, you sort of think, maybe everybody should stay at university longer and get jobs later. That actually it's almost as if we need to extend childhood a bit more. Because at the moment, trying to be a grown-up in your early 20s is almost impossible, because the where you live and how you struggle to find work is just really, really compromising.
In terms of the milestones that sort of generally mark that journey from childhood into adulthood, you know, moving out, getting your first job, getting your first home, settling down and so on, they're being pushed back and back and back, aren't they? Because it's so expensive. But in other ways, I feel like young people are having to grow up too fast, in the sense of so much of the fun that used to go along with being young has been taken away because they can't afford to go to the pub at the end of the week, or they can't afford to go out for dinner on holiday. The joy of youth has been turned into a sort of a financial crippling almost.
Absolutely. And yet, of course, there are always those people who are flashing their lifestyle on Instagram or TikTok and making it very demoralising for a lot of young people. You're talking to someone who would very happily raise the threshold for an awful lot of kind of benchmarks, like the age at which you can drive, have sex, get married, vote.
Why, Lucy?
Say it again. Why?
Why? Yeah.
Partly because I think it would. Firstly, I think it would be tidier. It would be about this ridiculous thing that you can get married but you can't vote. That just obviously is really weird. But there's also that sense of, let's try and keep people learning about the world without giving them too much responsibility. Let's acknowledge that actually, whether you're 16, 17 or 18, you've still got an awful lot, as you say, of fun to have. Let's try and take the pressure off being, trying to pretend that you're too adult. Because, yeah, you can have sex at 16, but do you really want to? Do you want to be having sex at 16, or do you want to be finding a really amazing person to be having sex with at 20? And if you're going to live to 110 or 20, losing your virginity at 20 is not quite the big deal it was if you maybe were only living to the age of 50.
It's really interesting, and sort of letting people be young for longer in a way that at the moment it's very difficult because there's so much pressure on them.
Yes, I was thinking about this in particular because one of my godchildren has just graduated from university. And so it was really brought home to me quite what an amazing 3 years this young lady has had, and how, I mean, I've probably only heard a tenth of what has actually been going on, but oh my goodness, she is so happy to have had that experience. And one wants to feel that as many young people as possible can have that freedom to learn, to develop a trade, to broaden their network of friends, and therefore not necessarily hook up with too many people too soon, because it's just a beautiful world out there to be able to say, let's try and experiment with as many things as possible. And it is interesting that this research has come out about people who are staying together because financially they can't afford it. But sometimes you do want to think, maybe you shouldn't have been with that person in the first place, and that actually being single and coping on your own would maybe be a bigger life lesson and a more joyous experience than staying stuck in a relationship that's dragging you down.
Lucy, thank you very much indeed. As always, that's Lucy Beresford, psychotherapist and broadcaster. So two different questions there for you, linked. If you've ever been in a situation, ever, or you know someone who has, where you've had to stay in a relationship because of money, because you couldn't afford not to be in that relationship. Really love to hear from you this morning. 0345 6060 973. But this is a sign, isn't it, as Lucy and I were just talking about, of just how difficult it is to be young now, of how financial pressures are taking away the sorts of enjoyments and the sorts of privileges and the sorts of opportunities that people used to just take for granted in their teens and 20s. And if that is you, if you feel that because of money and a lack of it, you are really struggling as a young person, or you were really struggling when you were a bit younger, what was it that money took away from you in terms of your youth? What did you have to give up? What did you have to sacrifice? What did you have to miss out on? Because you just couldn't afford to do otherwise. 0345 6060 973. I guess the fundamental question here is, have we made it impossible to be young anymore? Is it really, really difficult in this day and age, with this economy, this cost of living crisis, to just enjoy being a young person and not have to worry about making a living and paying the rent and paying the bills, to just go out, have fun, go to the pub, go to gigs, all the rest of it? Is it getting harder and harder to do that, to do the things that young people have always done? Because young people haven't always had to pay what you are in rent, or the bills that you are. Young people haven't always had 0 hours contracts, where you think you got a job and then the next week you haven't got any shifts. How hard is it to be young in Britain in 2025? 0345 6060 973. And if you have been in that situation where you had to stay with somebody for money, maybe you were married, maybe you weren't, do pick up the phone this morning. 0345 6060 973 is the number to call. You can WhatsApp the same number. You can text me on 84850 or say, Alexa, send a comment to LBC. That other story we're talking about this hour, very much related to that. The news this morning that university students would have to work 20 hours a week just to pay their living costs. I mean, I think when I was at university, we're only going back longer than I'd like to think, but what, 10, 15 years ago? We were out, I did football, I played tennis, I played rugby, I did debating, I did all sorts of stuff. And that was between the nights out and the drinking and the gigs and all the rest of it. If I had had to work 20 hours a week at university, on top of the course and the degree, just to make ends meet, my uni experience would have been drastically worse. Would have been nowhere near as fun as it was. It would not have been the best time of my life in the way that for many people I think it is. And this is what young people are right now having to deal with. So if that is you, maybe it was you doing 20-hour work weeks on top of your degree. 0345 606 0973. This warning this morning, as this report puts it, the pressures of part-time work are squeezing out the other elements of a university experience like studying, sports, societies and socialising. That didn't used to be the case, did it? It's just another example of how young people can't have as much fun as their parents and grandparents did because of the financial pressure they're under. And if that is you, or it was you, give me a ring. Come to your calls straight after this.
This is LBC.
Being an adult sucks. Adults, they have to work all day.
When adults get mail, it's always bills, and bills suck.
Sure, but we've got a driver's license.
Take advantage of Blue Week to enjoy 1.9% APR representative with up to £1,000 deposit contribution on certain models in the new Alpine A290 range at your Alpine store. PCP Mobilised Financial Services. Order between the 8th and the 25th of August. T&Cs apply.
And now the weather. Scattered showers will give way to more scattered showers, but there may be a period in between where it's just grey. It's always grey, isn't it? That's why I travel with Monzo. I can use my card to spend abroad with no fees, so I can plonk myself on a beach far away from grey and spend with my Monzo card like I never left home. Hello, Beach Bar. Now to Liam for the sport. Monzo, the bank made for travel. UK residents, T's and C's apply.
Ben Kentish on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
At 12.23 is the time. Ben Kentish here with you on LBC this morning. I mean, 21% of 18 to 40-year-olds has choosing to live with a partner primarily to make living costs more unaffordable. The organisation that carried out that survey saying these stats are shocking. People are potentially staying in unhappy relationships because the bills are too high to contemplate managing on their own. And then they say this, interesting, it's a tax on being single made worse by the rising costs of bills, which is an interesting kind of other element to this, isn't it? If you are single and you are in your late teens or your 20s or even your 30s, life is so much harder because there's nobody to split the rent with or split the bill with, unless you're living with friends the whole time, unless you're living with strangers the whole time. It's a hell of a lot easier if you are in a pair. It is, in a way, a tax on being single, and that is leading to people who want to be single but are currently in a relationship staying in the relationship because the alternative is financially so much worse. 0345 606 0973. Keith's calling from Ormskirk to talk about this. Hi, Keith.
Hi, hi. How you doing?
Morning.
Yeah, I was just thinking about back to the 80s when I lost my job through the, you know, there's lots of redundancies in the 1980s, and I had a mortgage. I married young. I was a typical working class lad. I had two young kids, and I'd lost my job. And do you know what? I could still manage to pay my mortgage. It was just a two up and two down. I could still manage to pay my mortgage, could still manage to pay my bills. My wife was working. I was having some mental issues at the time. And you know, my wife went to work. I looked after the kids. I took my, you know, son to school. I looked after my daughter in the daytime. We could still manage to pay the bills. We could still manage to pay the mortgage, yeah, you know. But we couldn't progress. We couldn't move on. And I sort of left school without qualifications. And I could always read. I was always a good reader, thanks to my father. Always sort of, he was a reader. My elder brother was a good reader, and my elder sister was. And I read books. So, and all of a sudden, at age 25, my head was on fire. I was reading books. I was reading literature and philosophy and popular science and God knows what. I said, I want a degree. I want to go back to university. And all the opportunities were there.
It was free. It was free, Keith, wasn't it?
And I didn't even know about this. I went to college, said blah, 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 blah. And they took me into a room and said, right, okay, there's this thing called an access course, but you have to sit and write an essay on a topic. And I did. And it's probably a load of rubbish what I wrote, but it was coherent. Mm. And it must have been enough for them to say, right, okay, we've got something here we can deal with. And so they put me on the access course. And my first marks in that year were not particularly good, but at the end of the year, I was getting really good grades and offers. I passed the matriculation course at Liverpool University.
Good on you, but are you saying that these are the opportunities that young people just wouldn't be able to access as much now because they wouldn't be able to get the free education? A lot of them have got to work.
You know, my son is stuck. My son, you know, is, you know, I had him when I was 22, and he's 40 odd now, and he's just stuck in a job which he hates. And
what does he do, Keith?
He's in the food industry, working in kitchens, and he doesn't like it. And I know how he feels because I've done those jobs. I've done jobs which you would just make you crawl the bloody walls
People have always had to do jobs they don't like to pay the bills.
Yeah, they do.
What's different now is that those people didn't have £80,000 of debt and a university degree.
I think the state, we're living in a capitalist system. My own particular political belief is we need a bit of capitalism and we need a bit of socialism. So I've always voted Labour.
A bit of capitalism and a bit of socialism.
I consider myself a social democrat, but, you know, but we need business, we need people to sort of, we need entrepreneurs, and we need that. Of course we do. There's no doubt about that. But we need the state to support people, young people, to be able to get onto courses and do.
Do you think it's got a lot harder to be young than it was when you were growing up?
Oh, I would. You know, I went into teaching. You know, I got my degree and I worked with my brother for a while and helped him with his business. And
do you think it's a lot harder for young people now than it was when you were growing up?
Oh, definitely, definitely, absolutely. I could go into an access course. I went to, became a teacher. I'm 65 now, 66 next year, my 30th year of teaching. And until I went into teaching, every single job I had, it bored the life out of me because I had no qualifications. The minute I went on to an access course, got qualifications, had choices, had opportunities, went into teaching, and I loved it.
And you had the opportunity to get onto a different path, one that made you a lot happier than the one you were on. And you can't help but wonder whether this generation that are doing everything that's asked of them, despite what certain papers and journalists would have you believe, working hard, getting their grades, going to university, getting their degrees, leaving ambitious, full of dreams, full of hopes and ambitions, and end up cleaning floors or you know, pulling pints. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's not what they dreamt of doing, because the society that they live in hasn't fulfilled its side of the bargain. They've done what they was asked of them, and they were told that they would get certain things, and those certain things have not been forthcoming. So they have to do all sorts of jobs just to pay the bills. It leaves nothing left over to be have fun and enjoy themselves and be young. And now more and more of them are having to stay in relationships that they don't want to be in just because of the financial situation. Devastating what we've done to young people. Thank you, Keith, for the call. More, of course, to come on this in just a moment. Plus,
everyone should be having that eyes tested every 2 years. There's been a number of cases highlighted by the coroner of people not having that eyes tested and then getting into accidents on the road.
Over 75s who fail mandatory driving tests will reportedly be banned from the roads under new government plans. This is in relation to eye tests. But should there be a compulsory driving test for all elderly people? Interesting your thoughts on that. 0345 606 0973. We'll talk more about that after the news headlines, 12:30 the time. Here's Matt Hewitt.
The funeral's been held for five journalists who were targeted by an Israeli airstrike in Gaza on Sunday night, with the UN saying the killings were a grave breach of international law. Anas al-Sharif was the best known amongst them for his work on Al Jazeera. The network strongly denies Israel's renewed claim he was a terrorist. Nurses are facing abhorrent levels of violence in casualty departments, including being punched and spat at, according to the Royal College of Nursing. Figures gathered from around three-quarters of A&E hospitals reveal 4,000 violent incidents last year. And Keir Starmer and the Canadian Prime Minister have agreed on a call that peace in Ukraine must be built with Kyiv, not imposed upon it. Donald Trump's due to meet Russia's President Putin, but not Ukraine's President Zelensky, in Alaska on Friday. LBC weather, mainly dry and clear overnight, with some spots of rain in the north of the UK, lows of 13 to 19. That rain fizzling out in the morning to leave blue skies almost everywhere. A heat health alert is in place across England. Highs of 22 to 34 degrees.
LBC. When Matthew's gaming, yeah! Mum's on a work call.
Blah, blah, sales targets.
And Amy is on social media. Is your broadband ready to explode? With Lightning Fibre's lightning fast, rock solid full fibre broadband, you get all the speeds you need all the time. Check availability and sign up at lightningfibre.co.uk.
Lightning Fibre, full fibre that rocks.
At EDF, we don't just encourage you to use less electricity. We actually reward you for it. That's why when you use less during peak times on weekdays, we give you free electricity on Sundays. How you use it is up to you. EDF. Change is in our power. Households who reduce their weekday peak electricity usage by 50% can earn up to 16 hours of free electricity per week. For full details, eligibility and T's and C's, visit edfenergy.com/r-power.
This is LBC. Message Ben Kentish on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060973.
We'll talk in a moment about whether over 65s or maybe even over 70s should have to pass a compulsory driving test to prove that they are still fit to be on the roads. That's going to get a lot of people pretty angry, isn't it? But isn't it a good idea to protect everybody else? Your eyesight declines, your mental faculty. I mean, this is brunt, but it's true. Your spatial awareness declines, your reaction speeds decline. I see it all the time driving around London, people doing 4 miles an hour in their little Nissan Micras. Full sympathy for them. I don't want to take away their lifeline. But if you're not safe to drive, then I'm afraid you shouldn't be driving. So should there be a compulsory driving test when you get to a certain age in order to prove that you're still safe to drive? 0345 6060 973. See what a motoring journalist thinks of that in just a moment. First, let's come back to our calls, your calls, I should say, about how difficult it is being young and what the financial pressures on today's generation as they grow up, what they are forcing those young people to miss out on. 20 hours a week, 20 hours work a week, just to meet the living costs of university. One in five people aged 18 to 40 having stayed in a relationship that they weren't happy in just to help pay the bills. If that resonates with you, 0345 6060 973. Let's talk to Simon in Chelmsford this morning. Morning to you, Simon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good. I think the problem here is, to be honest, we had easy access to credit back in my day, which was the 80s and 90s. And yes, you all run up incredible, horrible debts that you probably couldn't afford. But we were also had access to get a mortgage.
Yes.
And, you know, and I think that's the big difference.
Because that's life-changing, isn't it? If you're no longer throwing thousands and thousands of pounds a year down the drain because you're just giving it to a landlord for the privilege of having a roof over your head, instead, you're using it to build up an asset, you're building up equity in your home, Simon. That sets you up for life.
You had access to it.
Exactly. And that's what young people are missing out on right now, today.
100%. But We also, back in the day, had credit cards that, a very stupid young age, had £15,000 of limit on it, and we would abuse that to hell as well.
When you get a lot of people, I see a lot of people, you see certain newspaper columnists saying, it's never been so easy to be young. These young people don't know how lucky they are. They should get a grip and stop eating so many avocados and it would all be well. What do you make of that argument?
Well, that's a tough one, isn't it? We were all young once.
But there seems to be this kind of concerted effort in some quarters to blame young people themselves for the difficulties that they're facing. You think that's unfair?
To the things that we had. What I had when I was their age. We had access to be able to get a mortgage. It wasn't
defined as well whether you were, you know, if you apply for a mortgage, whether you were allowed to be in a sports club and how much you spend on this and how much you spend on that. And it was never broken down like that. It was just, okay, you earn that. Can your employer verify that? Yes, he can. There's your mortgage.
How old were you when you bought your first place then?
19.
Wow. Yeah. And what were you working at the time?
Fitting office furniture up in London.
And dare I ask what you paid for your place?
48,000.
48 grand. Wow.
It was a little two-bedroom flat.
Wow. And the mortgage covered all of it, pretty much?
I lied about it, obviously, clearly. But we got the mortgage to get it.
Yeah.
And, paid it for a while. But that was the privilege we had at that age. We were allowed to borrow that money.
Yeah. And 48 grand.
You know, and we paid it.
You wouldn't barely buy a fence and two fences for sort of the garage for 48 grand now. Lovely to talk to you, Simon, this morning. Thank you very much, Nid, for calling in. Come back to your thoughts on that in just a moment. I also want your calls on this, though, between now and 1 o'clock, the next 20 minutes or so. The government clamping down on dangerous drivers with a whole series of measures, which we'll touch on in a moment. But it has prompted a new debate, a sort of a resurrection of an old debate, actually, about elderly drivers and whether it's really a good idea to just say to somebody, right, you could drive perfectly well enough when you're 18, so you can continue driving around this country in a potentially deadly vehicle for the next 80 years. Or should there be some sort of check as people get older, maybe even 50, but certainly 65 or 70, to say, okay, all right, you passed your test 45 years ago. We just want to make you do another one to make sure you're still up to speed. Or not too up to speed, if you see what I mean. 0345 606 0973. Would you support driving tests, for the compulsory driving tests for the elderly? Is that a good idea? Let's talk to Maria McCarthy about it, motoring journalist, author of the book 50 Ways to Overcome Driving Test Nerves. Maria, very good morning to you. Let's start with this sort of government announcement that they are trying to ramp up road safety, including changing what older people can do in relation to driving and their health. Just tell us what's happening.
Well, the government has got a number of plans that it wants to bring in to improve road safety. And they include things like, you know, reducing the drink drive limit, rules around all passengers wearing seat belts, i.e. backseat passengers, and getting points on your license if you don't, and so forth. But the one that's really grabbed people's attention is this whole idea of over 70s having to have eye tests in order to be able to continue driving. Now, I actually think that we should all have eye tests regardless of age.
All of us.
Because basically what happens, is, you know, you stand there and you read your number plate, you know, just before your driving test when you are in fear and trembling, and you never in the UK have your eye tested ever again. And I think that it should be tied in with your driving license has to be renewed every 10 years anyway, you know, with your photo details updated and so forth. Is that would be a perfect time, whether you're, you know, 27, 37, 87, to just have an eye test and just see where you are. Because it's not necessarily that, you know, if you fail it, you're going to be sort of banished from the road. You might just need driving glasses.
Fair point. I mean, I'm short-sighted, not very, but I'm short-sighted enough that I can't legally drive without my glasses, and I don't because I can't see. And that started when I was about 25. So the idea it only affects people in their 70s, I guess, is, you know, there's loads of us younger people that are wearing glasses to drive.
Exactly. I mean, with myself, I was in my mid-40s and I needed reading glasses.
Yeah.
And I went in for another check and my optician said to me, actually, you need driving glasses as well now. And I thought, really? Because, you know, I knew I needed reading glasses, but I wasn't aware of any problems with driving. But when they were made for me and I put them on, everything just sort of sharpened up.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, my goodness. You know, so I think people, you know, in all may have the best possible motives, but may not realise that they need driving glasses, you know, and they might be, you know, forget about 70. They might be like, you know, 45, 55 or whatever.
And at the moment, we just sort of leave it up to people to decide for themselves, don't we, to be responsible and say, actually, I think I should get my eyes checked. I've noticed a bit of a decline. Do you think it's a bit unfair then, Maria, that elderly people are being kind of singled out for this test?
Yeah, I do. I do. You know, I think that we've got lots of sort of like, you know, issues around ageism in our country. And I think that, you know, making it just the older people that have to be tested, you know, is unfair. And I think that everybody should be tested because it's not like it's a difficult test or an expensive test or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, you could just like, you know, walk away with a pair of driving glasses and you're fine. And another thing, of course, that's a problem as people get older is, recovery from dazzle. You know, as you're driving along and another vehicle is coming towards you on, say, a deserted road.
Mm.
When you're sort of like, you know, about 17, it takes you about 2 seconds to recover from that dazzle. When you're older, say 65, it can be about 9 seconds. So it's
right.
A long time. But if you're wearing driving glasses, it's not like they can make everything okay. But because your eyes are more relaxed anyway, because you've got the glasses, it can help you cope with the dazzle. So, you know, I think that having driving glasses, if you need them, is beneficial on all sorts of levels.
Let me just ask you about that, if I could, because there has been a bit of a sort of ongoing debate that's reared its head again recently about whether it's not just an eye test that older people should have to do, but actually another driving test. Because for many people, it might be, you know, 50, 60 years even since they last passed their test. It's a fact, isn't it, sadly, that people's eyesight declines, but so too do their reaction times and other kind of biological things as they get older. And most accidents tend to involve younger people or older people. Do you think it would be controversial, wouldn't it, Maria? But do you think it would be a good idea if when you got to the age of, I don't know, 70, you weren't allowed to drive anymore until you proved that you could?
I think that idea of driving tests for the over 70s or anybody, you know, in the middle of their driving life is absolutely terrifying, for people.
Terrifying.
Terrifying and also like difficult to administer. I've actually written a book called, 50 Ways to Overcome Driving Test Nerves. And I think that the idea for most people going back to a driving test and being watched by someone with a clipboard, you know, it's just terrifying.
We're giving people the right to drive deadly vehicles that could kill many other people on the basis of a test they passed 50 years ago. Is that a good idea?
I think that I think that administratively, in terms of like money, like calling people in the middle of their life, whether it's like, you know, it's like, you know, 40 or 70 or whatever, and all of a sudden saying, you know, you've got to stump up money for like a whole load of refresher lessons, which people would probably
need. Well, if you need lessons, then you surely shouldn't be driving in the first place. Most people, if you know how to drive, you wouldn't need more lessons, would you?
I think what happens with a lot of people as they get older is that they don't drive to the same standard that perhaps they did when they were younger. I'm talking about much older people now. But what they do is they wind their neck in, as it were. So they know that they can't drive on motorways anymore.
Right.
So they just like, you know, they might drive to the supermarket, you know, to their local social club or whatever. But they don't sort of like, you know, bomb away to sort of like, you know, from like, you know, Cornwall to Carlisle in the way that they might have done when they were 25.
Sure.
So I think holding people to that standard doesn't really
a lot of damage
work.
On the way to the supermarket. You can kill a cyclist or a pedestrian or another vehicle. I just worry a bit that we're kind of being a bit all too polite about this. We don't want to offend anyone, we don't want to make difficulties, so we're letting people drive around who really shouldn't be driving. Maybe
I think that a middle ground can be reached by having, and I've suggested this before, is having what I would call a driving doctor. So basically you go to a doctor, it's a proper doctor, but not like your GP with whom you might have a relationship. And they test various things, which are things like, say, you know, your eyesight and your reflexes, you know, perhaps some basic sort of cognitive tests and so forth to see if you are capable of still being on the road. So it's not like having to do the whole thing of like, you know, and at the next roundabout, take the third junction
Can you parallel park? And how's your reversing round the bend?
Exactly.
Yes.
Well, actually, it's funny you should mention parallel parking because that was only brought in the early 90s. So there's a lot of people out there on... Yeah. So like 1991.
But this is my point, respectfully, that driving changes, technology changes. Just because you could drive a Morris Minor in 1940, it doesn't mean that you're fit to drive a Tesla around the streets of London now. That's why I just think there probably does need to be. I take your point about the doctor. Seems like a good idea to me. But I just think, you know, we need to sort of maybe clamp down a bit on unsafe older drivers.
I think that it's really interesting, actually, about the whole idea about being unsafe. And I wrote an article about this ages ago. Is that people are meant to sort of, you know, self-identify themselves, you know, and like hand back their license and so forth. They feel that they're not safe to drive. And like the vast majority of older people will actually just drive less and less and less and less and less until they don't drive at all.
Right.
Most of them are completely responsible, but some of them aren't.
Yes,
and some people, family members, are like, I really don't think my parents are safe to drive anymore.
It's everyone else so, that can see it, even if they can't.
Yeah. And so, you know, what do you do? And of course, one thing that is actually possible to do, but you know, once you have to wrestle so much with your conscience on both sides, is to report them to DVLA, because then
what, your own parents?
To report your own parent, and then they get summoned into the doctor or whatever, and have to sort of like have some sort of chat with them and be checked and so forth. And then so you'd either have to say to your parent you're going to do that, or you'd have to like not think
to do it discreetly.
Really? Has that been dobbed you in?
Gosh, it must be, you wouldn't be very popular, would you? But I guess it's for their, it's not for the greater good, it's for their own safety as well. You know, you're thinking of their health and their well-being.
Exactly. It is really horrible. It's a really, really, it's a real moral maze.
Mm.
And, you know, one that, you know, I'm sort of like, you know, grateful I haven't had to go through personally, you know, because my parents, like, you know, died very long time ago. But yeah, you know, it is a tricky one. It really is.
Thank you, Maria. Maria McCarthy, motoring journalist and author of the book 50 Ways to Overcome Driving Test Nerves. What do you think of that? Then quite a few people, I'll read some of these in a moment, getting in touch to talk about what other countries do. And a lot of other countries do say that you don't just do one test when you're 17 or 18 and that's it for life. That they do want people to continue to prove that they're fit enough to drive. Why do we take a different approach? Aren't we just setting ourselves up for more incidents, more road deaths, more trouble? It wouldn't be popular, but if the government said, right, maybe even every 10 years, however old you are, you have to redo some sort of driving test or a refresher course. But particularly if you are over the age of 65 or 70, then maybe every 5 years you still have to prove to an assessor that you are still fit for to drive. Is there a good argument against that, apart from kind of tiptoeing around not wanting to offend older people? Because I don't see one. 0345 606 0973 to your calls on that just after this, 12:48.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
The Home Secretary has defended the arrest of more than 500 people for holding signs supporting the group Palestine Action this morning. Is this an unacceptable infringement of their freedom of speech?
Richard Spur on LBC.
Right. Any chance you could give me a hand with dinner?
Sure. Think you can manage after Dad totally smashed it last night?
Of course. I've got a HelloFresh dinner coming up, so watch out.
Wow, this is good. We're on a roll this week.
HelloFresh brings the inspiration back to dinner time. Fresh ingredients, tasty recipes, and no more staring blankly into the fridge. HelloFresh. Nothing beats dinner time. Hello.
Water. It's the start of everything. It's the foundation for life, opportunity, and growth. Without it, everything stops. Every 23 seconds, someone dies from diseases caused by unsafe water. At WaterAid, we work with communities around the world to make sure everyone has clean water. Because change starts with water. Search WaterAid to find out how.
Mr. Thing is enjoying a lovely summer's day. He's trimmed the hedge, he's cut the grass, and best of all, he's just had 25% snipped off his home care cover, meaning his boiler, electrics, plumbing and drains are now covered for less. Chop chop, sign up today. This offer ends soon. Search British Gas Home Care Cover. Watch out for that rake, Mr. Thing. Ouch! Too late. British Gas. Taking care of things. T's and C's apply. Offer not available to existing home care or boiler service contract customers. Ends 9th of September 2025.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with Ben Kentish. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
10 to 1 the time. Ben Kentish here with you this morning on LBC. Nicola's called from Chelmsford to talk about driving tests for the elderly. Nicola, morning. What do you think?
Yeah, my father's 88 and he's still driving. So he does a voluntary assessment, it's not a test, every year with like the advanced drivers. So they take him around the local area in his car for about an hour or so, and then assess whether he's excellent, competent, you know, all the way down. It's not a legal thing, so that if they don't think he's competent, they can't stop him from driving, but he does get a report and assistance. So as a family, we're quite happy that he continues to drive. And he's agreed that once they say, you really shouldn't be driving, that he'll give up. So that has taken that horrible decision or that horrible conversation away from the family.
What about whether you should grass up your parents, the DVLA, that like Maria was talking about?
Yeah, yeah. So as long as he's getting... So he got all level twos a couple of months ago. So he's classed as competent across all the areas that
they
tested.
So he does this is every single year, did you say?
Yeah, he voluntarily paid to go and do it.
Right, and was that something that you asked him to do as a family?
So the first one, I mean, he said he was seen it and was interested in it. So the first one he did, I bought him as a Christmas present.
Right.
And now it's like ex-police drivers that take him out. So since then, he's been happy to do it annually. He's probably been doing it for 4 or 5 years.
He's a very responsible man by the sounds of it, Nicola. But the bottom is,
yeah,
isn't
no, he's, yeah, he's.
I mean, I think back to my grandma, God bless her soul. And amazing grandma, loved her to bits. What a woman. But my goodness, I think she thought she loved Formula One, absolutely loved Formula One. And I think she thought she was in Silverstone when she was driving around North London in a little red Nissan Micra. My goodness, I went in that car a few times. she wouldn't have passed your dad's test, I don't think. So the problem is, isn't it, not everyone's as responsible as your dad. So maybe the sort of voluntary thing that he's doing should be compulsory for other people.
Yeah, and yes, like you say, that if it was then compulsory, then that's, you know, like you say, it's that horrible conversation and decision that the family has to make because they don't realise, like you said, you know,
can you imagine ever snitching on him?
And everything else.
Can you imagine ever having to snitch on him? If he refused to do it and you were like, Dad, you're nowhere near fit enough to do this. Can you imagine ever ringing up the DVLA in the way that Maria was suggesting and snitching on him?
Well, I suppose it comes a point where maybe you have to because it's not just him. He's driving my mother around. Yeah. She's got dementia. There's, you know, like, I don't know, drive past the local school, whatever it is. So there comes a point where you would have to do it for their good and for the greater.
Crazy that we leave
My mum's got dementia. I mean, she's not got driving license.
Sorry.
But, you wouldn't, there's no way that you could let...
but it's mad, isn't it, that we completely rely on people like you and your dad being responsible, Nicola, rather than saying, actually, you know, you're driving around, some of these people might be driving big vans. And I think the rules, HGVs is different. I think the rules are the same for vans. You're driving a vehicle that caused a pile-up on the M1, and we have no idea if you can actually see at all, but you just let us know if you think your eyesight's gone too bad. It's really, really sort of risky the way that we go about completely asking individuals to be responsible for their own decisions on this, isn't it? And not everyone is going to be as responsible as Nicola's dad. Thank you, Nicola. Lovely to talk to you this morning. Helen is in Addleston in Surrey. Morning, Helen. Helen, are you there? I can't say that, Helen. No, Helen, you can't say that. Come on, Helen. Be sensible. All right. OK, well, agree to disagree. Try and get Helen back on a better line. Thank you, Helen, for the call nonetheless. It's Carol in Coventry. Hi, Carol.
Hello.
Hey, there we go. How are you doing, Carol?
I'm all right. Thank you. You?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you. Compulsory driving test for the elderly. What do you think?
Well, I think that I disagree with it, to be honest with you. I think when they hit 70, yes. But I think the 65 is ridiculous. You can't get your pension until you're 67.
Mm. So yes, but only at 70.
I think at 70, yes, there's an awful lot of drivers that maybe can't drive as well at 70. There's an awful lot of drivers that pass the test at 18 or 17 and they can't drive at all.
Yes, very true. And then they spend the next 60 years doing it. This is why I just think it's mad just to say, well, actually, 60 years ago, you were sort of just about good enough to pass your test. But now, you know, we're going to let you drive for the rest of your life. Mad, isn't it? I mean, I'm missing. Well, it just seems to me totally mad that that's our system.
I think everybody, when they pass the test, None of us could have. Well, none of us could drive. I think you learnt to drive as time's gone on. I think you know the. I mean, I'm only 4 years away from 65 myself.
Ah, this is what you need. You should be 70, Carol.
Yeah, of course, of course. You know, I'm on the road every day.
If you were 69, you'd think you should be 75, wouldn't you?
Of course, 80. but you know, I just think that there are so many rules and regulations coming into the UK. You know, you've got, and I don't want to get into the subject of, you know, foreign people or anything like that coming over, but there's an awful lot of them that are driving and doing these Uber deliveries and so on, and these people can't drive.
Well, what you're talking about, you spot on, the roads have changed, the cars have changed, the vehicles have changed, the regulations have changed, the other drivers have changed, e-bikes everywhere. Just because you could drive on a street in 1952, it doesn't mean that you're qualified to drive on one in 2025, does it? Thank you, Carol. I think we've got Helen in Addlesden back on a better line. Hi, Helen.
Hello, Ben.
There
how
you are. Hello. How are you doing?
I'm all right.
Good.
I was about to go sleep.
And oh, I've
heard
kept you
talk
awake.
About this. Well, yeah. My friend suggested I listen to LBC. It would help me go to sleep.
Oh, dear. And the opposite's true. I've kept you up.
You have.
Well, yes. Your friend said if you listen to Ben Kentish on LBC, it would help you fall asleep. That's nice, isn't it? Oh, who's your friend, Helen?
Pardon?
I might have to have a word. Who's your friend?
Leslie.
Listen to Ben Kentish on LBC. It'll help you doze off. Charming. Leslie. Thanks, Leslie. talk to me about elderly drivers. Come on.
Right, I'm 72.
Yep.
And I have no other way of getting to the shops for shopping, hospital visits, whatever. The bus service here stopped and the nearest bus is a mile and a half away.
Right.
And then there's a little bus that comes between 9:30 and 2. And if you miss that bus at 2, it's a £15 taxi.
So it's a lifeline for you, Helen.
It's a lifeline. It's a lifeline for many people my age, especially if we live in semi-rural area.
Yes, I hear you. And it would be...
I personally have never driven on the motorway.
Why not?
I've never wanted to.
Okay.
Petrified by it.
Okay.
I just use my car for a local area.
And if that was taken away because you failed this test...
What would I do?
It would be a disaster.
Yeah.
I hear you. It's really tricky. And yet, you know, you don't want you or don't want anyone driving on the road for your own sake if it's not safe.
Yeah. There are people I see, older people driving, and think definitely they shouldn't be on the road.
Yeah. And it might be a lifeline for them as well.
Yeah. But the eyesight test, most of us elderly people have our eyes tested every year.
Yes. But it's still on you, isn't it, to declare whether you think your eyesight's good enough. Even if your optician says you maybe shouldn't be driving, yeah. I think it's on you to then stop driving.
Absolutely.
There's no compulsory test.
I would stop driving if the optician said I couldn't drive anymore.
Yes, but other people might not. Other people might say, well, tough, I'm not giving up my car even if I can't see out the windscreen. Yeah. And that's the worry, isn't it? There's no obligation here.
I know. But why pick on the elderly? Everything today is picked on the elderly.
It's not. This is about protecting the elderly as much as anything.
Well,
this is about
saying, look, it's taken away.
It is. I hear you. It's
everything for you.
It's not easy, but it's also potentially saving their life and those of other people as well.
And then, as that lady before said, the youngsters on these Uber bikes delivering food.
Yeah.
Are a nightmare on the road.
I know, we rely on them for our dinners, but they are a bit of a menace on the streets, I'll give you that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Helen. Yeah. I'm out of time, I'm afraid. Glad you stayed up, though.
I'm going to sleep now, thank you.
Oh, well, Richard's just come in. You can't go to sleep now. tell Leslie, Helen, that she's wrong on this. LBC will keep you awake, riveted, with high-quality radio. She's not right.
Within half an hour, you're asleep.
Oh, charming. Well, good night to you, Helen.
Good night, sir.
Sleep well. Thank you, Helen in Addlesden. Sorry, Richard, you can go home now.
It's an outrage. It's Leslie. Leslie is to blame for all of
this. Well, if Leslie wants to listen to tonight's show, or you, Helen, you can listen, catch up on Global Player. That is available right now. You can also get this show and all the others on the new LBC app, which you can download for free from your app store right now as well. Coming up on 4 on LBC. Do stay tuned, even if Leslie and Helen on. Ian Payne will be here right now. Here's Richard Spur.
All right, still to come. High street retailers say that theft is spiraling. spiralling out of control after official figures show that shoplifting in England and Wales is at its highest level since records began. I'll be asking if you have any sympathy with people who steal from shops, or should they be treated like any other criminal? But first, Yvette Cooper has rejected criticism of the arrest of more than 500 men and women who were accused of supporting a proscribed terrorist organisation, Palestine Action. The Met Police have said, well, it was the largest number of arrests made related to a single operation in the last 10 years. The Home Secretary said the group were causing panic amongst innocent people and major criminal damage. So this morning, do you support the action of the government and the police? Or is this an undemocratic infringement of freedom of speech?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, President Trump says he'll tell President Putin to end the war in Ukraine when the pair meet on Friday. Sir Keir Starmer and the Canadian Prime Minister spoke in the last few hours, agreeing that peace must be built with Kyiv, not imposed upon it. Reporter John Domen at WTOP in Washington, D.C. says if Mr. Trump loses patience, Europe will have to come to Ukraine's aid.
I think you'll see a risk of further erosion of U.S. support for the Ukrainians, depending on how things go on Friday. And if that happens, then there'll be even greater burden being placed on the Europeans to support the Ukrainians at this point.
The IDF is renewing its claim that a journalist it killed in Gaza was a terrorist. The Israel Defense Force has been criticized by the EU for providing limited evidence that Anas al-Sharif was a member of Hamas. But it says it has only provided a small, declassified portion of the intelligence it holds. Israel killed at least four other journalists in Sunday's airstrike, branded an attack on truth itself by a Palestinian activist. Shoplifting has surged in most UK pharmacies in the past year. The National Pharmacy Association says almost 9 in 10 have reported aggressive behaviour, including bricks thrown through windows and attacks on staff. Boss Henry Gregg wants the NHS to improve security.
They give specific funding to GPs to make their premises more secure with modifications like CCTV and panic buttons, and we'd like to see that support also extended to pharmacists.
The government's making violence against shop workers a specific offence. Nurses are facing abhorrent levels of violence in casualty departments, according to the Royal College of Nursing. Figures gathered from around three quarters of A&E hospitals reveal 4,000 violent incidents last year. HMRC is admitting it uses artificial intelligence to spy on taxpayers' social media posts. The tax authority says its AI tools are only deployed in criminal investigations with robust safeguards in place. And an amber heat health alert kicks in across most of central and southern England this morning. NHS and social care could see more demand, and deaths among people over 65 could rise. Dr. Emma Wedgeworth from the British Skin Foundation says the more sun protection, the better.
It's behaviour, not sitting in direct sunlight where you can, covering up, hats, long sleeves, and a high SPF and broad spectrum sunscreen above SPF 30.
LBC weather, rain in West Wales fizzling out soon, and showers in western and northern Scotland for the next few hours. Dry elsewhere, lows from 13 to 19 degrees. Warm with blue skies almost everywhere for Tuesday, highs of 22 to 34 Celsius. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Matt Hewitt.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Richard Spur.
Good morning. Yvette Cooper has defended the arrest of more than 500 people for holding signs supporting the group Palestine Action. The Home Secretary said protesters over the weekend may have been objecting to the group being prescribed as a terror one because they don't know the full nature of the organisation. Ms Cooper said that could be due to reporting restrictions on court hearings whilst serious prosecutions were underway. A total of 532 people were arrested on suspicion of supporting a prescribed organisation contrary to Section 13 of the Terrorism Act 2000. Around half of them, and this is interesting, half of them were aged 60 and above, including almost 100 people who were in their 70s. The Metropolitan Police has said it was the largest number of arrests it's made related to a single operation in at least the past decade. This morning, I'd like to know whether you feel that the arrest and detention of those individuals was justified, or is it, as some might have it, an unacceptable infringement of their freedom of speech? 0345 6060973. Well, the Home Secretary said also that Palestine Action was simply not non-violent.
Well, prescription is not about protest around Palestine or Gaza, where we had, I think, tens of thousands of people protesting lawfully just this weekend about some of the horrendous events that we've seen in the Middle East. Instead, prescription is about one narrow group that has been involved in violent attacks, including injuries, including weapons, smoke bombs causing panic among innocent people, major criminal damage against national security infrastructure, and where there's been clear security assessments and advice. There may be people who are objecting to prescription who don't know the full nature of this organisation because of court restrictions on reporting while serious prosecutions are underway. But it's really important that no one's in any doubt that this is not a non-violent organisation.
Well, the Justice Minister, Alex Davies, reiterated that they are a terrorist organisation and suggested people don't support them.
What I would say is peaceful protest in our country is a cornerstone of our democracy. And there are thousands of people peacefully protesting the horrific scenes that they're seeing in Gaza. There are people protesting wanting to see the hostages released. And what I would say to those who want to support a proscribed terrorist organisation is please think again. Palestine Action are a terrorist organisation. They've been proscribed because of violent criminal action. They've targeted RAF aircraft. There are credible reports of them targeting Jewish-owned businesses in this country. They are not peaceful. And I would just say to anyone who is thinking about supporting them to think again.
Sean O'Grady, associate editor of The Independent, who wrote arresting hundreds for protesting against a ban on Palestine Action, shames us all, thinks this is ridiculous.
And it's so ridiculous, it's shaming. I mean, these people, there was an Oxford professor of poetry, for example, there's some, well, Sir Jonathan Porritt is an environmental advisor to Prince Charles. These people are not terrorists, and to call them terrorists really devalues the term terrorism.
But no one's saying they're terrorists. People are saying they are accused, and you know the pictures are there, of expressing their support for a proscribed terror group, which
that's
they
right.
were.
But it isn't a terror group. It is proscribed, but it's not a terror group. Terror group is what London went through on 7/7. It was 9/11. It was what Hamas did on October the 7th. It's what the IRA bombing campaign was all about. Striking terror, but killing people in you know, vast numbers sometimes. Those are terrorist organisations. Those are the things that should be proscribed. Those are places where, to a very large extent, people express support for them, like hate preachers, that sort of thing. They can be proscribed. They can be restrained.
Well, Katie McFadden, an associate solicitor at Hodge, Jones and Allen, is representing some of the protesters and gave her thoughts.
The case for the defence is that this was a group of people who were willing to go out to risk arrest, to risk prosecution and to risk, yes,